Good morning and welcome to the October 18th, 2011 San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors meeting. Would you please rise and join us in the flag salute?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay. Madam Clerk, I understand we do have a few technical snafus this morning, so please bear with us if you hear any silence or delay. Are there any changes to our agenda?
No, there's no changes.
Okay, thank you. Very good. With that, then, we will move into consent. I have no public request to speak on consent, so I will go to my colleagues and see if they have anything they'd like to comment or question on. Mr. Meacham?
No, sir.
Mr. Teixeira?
A5.
Okay. Mr. Gibson?
None, thank you.
And Mr. Patterson?
No, sir.
Okay, and I have none either. So, Mr. Teixeira, A5, please.
Thank you, Chairman Hill. I would just like to welcome everybody to the Oceano Public Library 6th Anniversary Celebration this Friday at the library. This is a monumental event for the community of Oceano. Small communities thrive with their libraries and other public places like this. I'd also like to comment on the people of Oceano and the effort they put forth this past weekend to do the community cleanup. It was a humongous task, but they all came together and did it, and we're upwards of 100 ton of trash and refuse that we took to the landfill and cleaned up that community. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mr. Meacham?
I would move to approve consent calendar.
Second. Okay, moved by Supervisor Meacham, second by Supervisor Teixeira. If there's no further comment on consent, Madam Clerk, a roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
And Mr. Hill?
Yes. Thank you, folks. I saw our distinguished tax collector just come in and ready to go out.
He's ready
with his
to
staff. All right. With that, we shall get to public comment. We have many requests, so if you have a request to speak on public comment, please get your slip in now so we can get you in the queue. We'll begin with David Schiller from SoCal Gas, Sempra, and followed by Dr. C. Height, please. Are you here, Dr.? There you are. Okay, good. Mr. Schiller.
Thank you, Chairperson Hill. I'm David Schiller with Southern California Gas Company. I'm here to just make a statement to clarify some information that was communicated at the last supervisor meeting. I'll be reading into the record portions of a letter dated October 4th from SoCal Gas legal counsel to the board and members of county staff. All of you received this package. Southern California Gas Company is concerned the board voted on the county's public improvement road standards ordinance based on inaccurate statements that occurred at the September 20th, 2011 Board of Supervisors meeting. Specifically, the statement was made that the gas company has never put in writing that it will warranty or repair any damage to the county's roads caused by the gas company's activities. In fact, the gas company has put it in writing that it will repair any damage to the county's roads caused by our activities. The existing franchise agreement is clear. It states that the gas company will, quote, repair any damage to any public street, way, alley, or place of the county if any portion thereof shall be damaged by reason of any cause arising from the operation or existence of any pipelines and appurtenances constructed or maintained under this franchise, such repair to be to the satisfaction of said Board of Supervisors. As to the franchise agreement currently being negotiated, the gas company has accepted language proposed by the county that it shall be liable to the county for all damages approximately resulting from the failure of grantee well and faithfully to observe and perform any provision of the franchise. In addition, the gas company has agreed that it shall pay to the county on demand the cost of all repairs to public property made necessary by any of the operations of the grantee under the franchise. This should set the record straight. After 5 years in negotiations, the franchise between the County of San Luis Obispo and Southern California Gas Company needs to be completed. For over 100 years, the gas company has been a friend to the community in conducting its business operations safely and reliably, and supporting community businesses and charitable activities. It's disappointing that after 5 years of trying to negotiate a franchise in good faith, these negotiations had not been concluded. We appreciate the time and your interest, specifically Chairman Hill, that you've given to these matters in trying to resolve the franchise. We believe it's appropriate to grant the gas company a waiver from the public improvement standards street ordinance, and it's appropriate to move forward by having the board consider the franchise agreement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schiller. We'll be in contact soon with SoCalGas. Dr. Height, followed by Bo Cooper, please.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos. Hopefully everyone is enjoying the County Arts Council's largest fundraising event, Open Studios Art Tour. And I've provided you all flyers for the tour. It is a time when artists contribute to their community by opening their workspace to the public to demonstrate how and where their artwork is created. Catalogs are free again this year, available online and at Arts Obispo and the Creamery. North County is on the tour this Saturday and Sunday, and in these tough economic times, the best way to support the arts and the artists is to attend. Los Osos has 27 artists and galleries on the tour, a yearly favorite because there are so many artists and it's a small community. And I am participating for my sixth year in this artful fundraiser. I've made an art form of living economically, sweeping the cedar for compost, saving water. And I bring today my family water can. This is how I save water. My mother, when we lived in Taiwan, had to boil and filter our drinking water. And this is what she used. We carried canteens to school. And it's amazing when you are doing something as simple as rinsing alfalfa sprouts how much water goes down the drain. And this sits by my kitchen sink, and I just pour off the clean water into this and use my water can, and that's how I'm saving water in Los Osos, and it's become a whole lifestyle and an art form. I'm opening my small garden, and there have been many changes there, and the theme of my presentation this year is Water War, which I dedicate to the people of Los Osos. Water wars are now fought in small gardens all over this county, in Los Osos, the Western Alkaline Lake System, and the world. And such wars tend to be ruthless and very dirty. And it was devastating when the director of the Mono Lake Committee was mysteriously killed in a one-car accident on a straight but narrow, isolated road, and yet hope prevailed, and I'm presenting my Mono Lake documentary as an example of hope this year. When wrong is so persistent that all words fail, we are left to gestures of resignation. And my brother, who could see something in what I was creating, and asked me, "Are you mourning the death of a lake?" With such persistence, the balance of power can shift. With such gestures, the balance of power can shift and has shifted to the side of preservation and life. And when curiosity is pricked, expressing oneself brings awareness, and in Open Studios Tour, people listen, including your international tourists who take this home with them. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Height. I do hope people avail themselves of Open Tours again this weekend. Mr. Cooper, followed by Ben DeFatta, please. Morning.
Good morning. Bo Cooper, Los Osos. Mr. Hill, you and I have had an email exchange that started off with my saying, I think you overstepped your boundaries by cutting off Lindy Owen last week. You responded when he said, there's a court case, Baca versus Moreno Valley Unified School District, 1996. Very important case that speaks to clarifying the Brown Act, which is the ruling for the public comment here. The Baca case, in my mind, clearly states that you cannot cut her off for what you did. I want to explain that a little bit. Your response to my original email saying you can't do that says, I don't think this matter is of legalistic retreat. It's not a legal issue. I think it's a matter of decency and civility. Of course, so many vile things can be defended under the hazy banner of what's democratic. I think the banner of West Democratic is not as hazy as you think. I appreciate your idea of decency and civility. I understand that law and order is important, but I think you've sacrificed law for your sense of what order is about. Okay, I want to read some of a summary that I've sent to all the whole board. I've sent both the whole Baca case and the summary. So I want to read some of it that I think clarifies that my point of view is a more correct one than yours, Mr. Hill. So Baca says, speech criticizing a district employee, even if later proved to be defamatory, is protected by both the California and federal constitutions from government censorship. Neither neither the United States nor California Constitution allows government to censor statements merely because they are false or defamatory. So even if you disagree, it can't be there. The court ruled that it will leave the determination of what is slanderous or false up to one man, in this case yourself, and that's against the California Constitution. It says California Constitution forbids censorship even by judges because this subjects all freedom of sentiment to the prejudices of one man, yourself, and makes him the arbitrary and infallible judge of all debatable points in learning, religion, and government. So it's real important that you cannot stop somebody from talking like that. You cannot cut off speech because the moderator disagrees with the view expressed. The First Amendment protects speech which is uninhibited, robust, wide open, vehement, caustic, and sharp, as well as speech which lacks truth, social utility, or popularity, which exaggerates or vilifies. It's a wide open forum. It's a privileged forum. It's different from being out in public because we can say anything and mean it and not get sued. It gives you a chance to really say what's going on. And I think you cannot stop Lindy from saying the kind of things she wanted to say. And I don't happen to agree that it was defamatory anyway. So please reconsider your position that it's okay. Thank you,
Mr. Cooper. Mr. DeFatta, followed by Pavo Ogren.
Good morning, Chairman Hill, board, sheriff, friends, Romans and countrymen, and DeFatta here from Los Osos. On the way to the forum this morning, I had a premonition you were going to turn off this microphone on some of us again. Don't you know that's a no-no? I don't know if you know it or not, but it takes a lot of determination, or even more. It takes courage, time, and money for anybody to come down here for a day or for many years, as we have, to comment and criticize our county fathers when they are wrong, which we hate to do. Gentlemen, this is no game you're playing here. People's lives are at stake. Usually one or more come here to bring something to your attention. Usually it's to right a wrong. Something you folks seem to think that people that come to this podium are troublemakers. Believe me, if our District 2 supervisor, who's supposed to represent all the people in the probation zone and not just the upper class, if Gibson Ogren would give us a good answer as to why they chose gravity instead of the $50 to $100 million cheaper alternatives, we would be glad to stay away from this place like the plague. Your attitude towards building this mega million-dollar sewer is like stealing money out of those that reside in Los Osos. You are taking advantage of folks that believe that you will do the right thing for them. And on the front page of the Sunday Times, more seniors facing hardships. Read it. It's very informative. When asking Mr. Gibson in hard questions, we hear answers like, we are on our way, we are way beyond that, or omits answering, and after 3 seconds then says, next. Then one of his cronies barges in with a so-called weak answer. He has never answered why those two chose gravity, or why no affordability study, or why no seismic study. Senator Blakeslee pointed out that the Diablo nuclear power plant and any kind of infrastructure along the coast should be considered as being in a liquefaction zone, and in our case, 50 miles of big pipes and deep trenches is in jeopardy of costly damage to man and property. Deferring cost, cronyism, no town hall meetings to keep the citizens that are paying for this antiquated, overpriced, unaffordable energy hog, not-so-green, stinking sludge maker gravity collection project is suspect. Investigative improprieties done by certain people without asking or looking at evidence that the public has offered, not returning phone calls or emails from the public, Self-investigation, what a joke. Very suspicious. Hateful, spiteful, evil, or in our case, the wasteful spending of the public's money is criminal. You bet the public is suspicious. Gibson or Ogren never looked at lower-cost alternatives. Treated much cheaper and better technologies, alternative bidders who spent time and resources as outcasts.
Thank you, Ben.
I got two more pages.
We'll get you. We'll get to you next week. Thank you. Pavo Ogren, followed by Lindy Owen, please.
Chairman Hill, members of the board, members of the public, Pavo Ogren, your public works director. Just a couple of bittersweet comments today. First off, a week ago last Sunday, a number of us were down in at the annual luncheon for the Los Angeles section of the American Society for Civil Engineers, where the Nos Mena Water Project got a Project of the Year award. ASCE is an international organization, and this comes with some of the highest honors that a project in San Luis Obispo County. Certainly the work efforts and the combined efforts of Paso Robles and San Luis Obispo, Templeton Community Services District, and Atascadero Mutual Water Company, as well as the county, contributed to the success of this project. Also, in addition, John Hollenbeck, the project manager, got the Los Angeles Section Engineer of the Year Award. Myself, part of my family, John and his wife, Carolyn Berg and Gregor Jones with the Atascadero Mutual Water Company all went down to the ceremonies. And to put it in a little bit of perspective, the Los Angeles section of ASCE comprises Mono, Inyo, San Luis Obispo, Kern, Santa Barbara, Ventura, Los Angeles, Orange, San Bernardino, and Riverside counties, a population of almost 20 million. So for San Luis Obispo to get this award in the context of all of these counties and that population certainly is noteworthy. San Luis Obispo County is about 1.3% of that combined population, so that might mean we get an award like this maybe every 40 or 50 years or so. Fact is, it's the second award of this nature in 6 years because the Lopez Seismic Remediation Project also obtained a similar award. The Nos Mena Project is one of 8 finalists for the national award. But these projects are not without their challenges, and so the sad news today is that we do want to make sure to also express the condolences to the families of Jesse Maldonado. Jesse was working for contract forces on the Willow Road Interchange Project last week. He fell ill during the project and then later in the evening passed away at Arroyo Grande Community Hospital. So condolences to the families of Jesse Maldonado as well.
Thank you. I think there's a question.
Mr. Chair, but if I may, just a comment. I think it's really important, and this award illustrates the significance of that project, the Nos Mena Water Project. I can remember in the early 90s when State Water was first being considered in San Luis Obispo County, the northern water purveyors, Paso, Templeton, Atascadero Mutual Water, as well as the city of San Luis Obispo, was weighing whether or not to tie in to the State Water Project versus build the Nos Mena Project, and they collectively chose to partner with the county to build the Nos Mena Project, in part because it's local water that we have local control over. We have a guaranteed allocation from Nos Mena, and since Nos Mena Dam was built and the reservoir filled, we have always been guaranteed that allocation, so it was a secure source of water in the minds of the water purveyors, and they went forward with this huge project, and now water was delivered for the first time in January of this year, so very successful. Thank you, Pavo, for bringing that good information to us, and you mentioned it's one of 8 finalists in the national awards.
That's
when
correct.
Will we find out how they fared in that competition?
That will be March of 2012 in just outside Washington, D.C.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Owen, followed by Eric Greening.
Good morning, everyone. Lindy Owen from the Occupy the Prohibition Zone movement in Los Osos. Just joking. Last week there was a little problem on my microphone, so I hope this week it works a little better. My background, again, let's go back over why we come here each week. I know the shredder thinks that we have nothing better to do. and we love to listen to ourselves, but believe me, I'd much rather be home. The reason that we do come each week and have for the last 4 years is that this project was taken away from Los Osos, who had a CSD that was elected to move a sewer outside of town and to look at a more affordable technology. So there's a setting. Then this project was taken over by AB 2701, which was stated with some help from your people that had to step down from this board. Gail Wilcox and David Edge had some work with Sam Blakesley to create 2701, which took it away from Los Osos, gave it to this county. The county then started off a project that was supposed to allow us to have we were supposed to choose the best technology and the most affordable. And at the beginning of the project, your prior chair, head of public works, Noel King, noted that they would not be looking at the alternative collection system, which is where the problem is. 70% of the cost of the program is in that collection system. So when you say that you are going to look at everything, yet you start off by saying you will not look at anything but, then we move on, and Mr. Ogren took the project over. He wasted 2 years. We've got over $8 million spent on what could have been a comparison, because that CSD had spent $500,000 on a design that the Ripley alternative had shown how it would be done, how we would not have earthquake, we would eliminate a lot of earthquake problems, we would not tear out the streets, we would put in the pressurized pipe system, and it was far superior and more appropriate for Los Osos. But Mr. Pavo did not want to go that direction, and so for the whatever 5 years now, it has gone nowhere. So the allegations that did not come out of my microphone last week and are in the accusation with this investigation that was not thorough at all from the county, on the combination of what happens when a CSD member takes up close relationship with the head of public works, and they both have influence on the project. That's where the investigation should have gone, and anybody in their right mind would not have let this county investigate themselves, because what we got was a one-page, two-sided piece of fluff. Ogren was temporarily running the Los Osos district when Montgomery Watson Harza was retained by the district for wastewater project management in early September 99. Prior to his work with the district, Ogren had worked for a subcontractor. That's where the connection is, and that's what you need to investigate. Thank you.
Eric, followed by Gwen Taylor, please.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening. I'm a grateful user of the First Amendment. Whenever I hear speakers that I agree with, I'm grateful for the First Amendment. When I hear speakers I disagree with, I'm grateful for the First Amendment. When I hear people presenting illuminating information, I'm grateful for the First Amendment. When I hear people presenting what I think is misinformation, I'm grateful for the First Amendment. And when I can get up here and correct what I think is misinformation, I'm grateful for the First Amendment. And I hope everyone in this room always treasures the First Amendment on that basis, and we all have the opportunity to use it. Before I hit my main point, just referring to a couple of past issues, certainly the Nacimiento project, I'm glad it received the reward. And on the bittersweet side of it, I don't think we should accept it without also remembering the lives that were lost in the creation of the Nacimiento project. Sometimes these things do come with a price. Also, I endorse the idea of visiting the open studios in the North County, and certainly just to understand the vitality of our arts community. I'm going to recommend that you take the coastal side on Saturday and the inland side, the 101 corridor, on Sunday, and you'll see why when I get to my main point. We have had first flush, and I'm not sure how much data the county is collecting. There is an organization, Surfrider, that is making its own efforts to find out where the problems in our ocean come from, trace them upstream. And, of course, water quality testing is an expensive proposition. They have an annual fundraiser to support this water quality testing effort, and it is an arts event. It's the Free Fall art benefit at the Cayucas Vets Hall at the foot of the pier, and it will be Saturday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., and that's the reason I'm recommending that people visiting the open studios include this as an arts event on the corridor. It's free unless you buy art or buy food, and then you're helping to support the water quality effort. And I believe all of us should remember, if we celebrate holidays with gift giving, that the most sustainable gifts in this county is food by local growers, art by local artists, books by local authors, recordings by local musicians. Keep supporting our local creative people, our local producing people, and the open studios weekends and the free fall art benefits are wonderful ways to do this. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. Ms. Taylor, followed by Tom Murphy.
Good morning. My name is Gwen Taylor, and I am a resident of Los Osos in the Prohibition Zone. The Ralph M. Brown Act is a state law that mandates open meetings by legislative bodies, local governments, as well as boards. That's you. The people do not yield their sovereignty to this or any other agency, nor do they give their public servants the right to decide what is good for them to know or not good for them to know. The people have a right to be heard by government. That means this board as well. The board can't say how you speak, limit how you express a point of view, limit the use of satire or metaphors. The public has the right to be heard, no matter how the message is presented. The public has that right. Don't ever forget it. The Brown Act is a state law, not a law that you or county council can pick and choose what you are going to abide by. Public trust in the board and county council is fastly waning. If this law that is the is to protect the public's right to know has so blatantly been disregarded, how many other laws have been disregarded and violated by either you or county council? The right to speak is a clear and abiding principle of democracy, not to be squelched by the chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Mr. Murphy, followed by Richard Margetson.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Tom Murphy. I'm here in the capacity of a private attorney general on behalf of the people of California. And I would like to enter into the record, first off, a certification of electronic recording that we have had validated here by the county clerk. That's into the record. Second, we would like to establish the American standard of jurisdictional hierarchy of attorney, lawyer, and counselor, which you have a copy of there. The private attorney general at the top is my authority, so there's no misunderstanding. Then I'd like to enter into the record a final order, adjudication and decree, granting petition and peremptory writ of mandamus. It's from Superior Court of Record. It is acknowledged by the clerk of the Court of Record, which is the county clerk. And it is to the Regional Water Quality Control Board. That order orders the Regional Water Quality Control Board to adopt the clean water standards that are that enable them to do this project in compliance with the law, the Clean Water Act. Further, we would like to bring to your attention that about a year ago, I came here and told you we had $500 million appropriated for the project. Well, we now have $2 billion appropriated. It's a joint project with Santa Barbara County, and we are seeking the sponsorship of the governor, Jerry Brown, California Water Board, Cal EPA, California Coastal Commission, and the two counties, San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara County. The primary purpose of this is these $2 billion are debt-forgiven funds, and we're able to bring the entire zone of the Coastal Commission into compliance and cease all discharges, all unlawful toxic discharges. I'll leave you with this. About 4 months ago, it was a U.S. EPA federal ruling that the fine and penalties for unlawful discharges not having at-source control is based on per day $25,000 and 3 years in prison per day of unlawful discharge. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Mr. Margetson, followed by Jerry Walsh, please.
Before I get into my comment, I just wanted to let you know I provided you each with a copy of the Baca decision. Which I think should be the handbook for how you handle public comment in the future. Now my comment. You five supervisors and your county council, upon assuming your current positions, swore an oath to defend the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of California. Last week, you all failed miserably in meeting this responsibility when you allowed Chairman Hill to interrupt, scold, and then turn off the microphone during Lindy Owens' constitutionally protected free speech rights during open public comment. Not one of you spoke up in her defense or attempted to seek legal counsel's advice on what I hope was an uncomfortable experience for all of you. If you were uncomfortable and still did nothing to right an obvious wrong, shame on you. If you believe Chairman Hill was justified in his actions, then you lack a basic understanding of what is protected speech. To have intervened on Lindy's behalf would have been noble. Sitting on your hands, however, was cowardly. You might not have liked the content of her comment, but none of you have the legal right to prohibit her from voicing her opinion, or in this case, reading from an article posted by a local news source. Our collective free speech rights levels the playing field between those with power and those without, and sets our country apart from the rest of the world. Any woman, man, child, senior citizen, homeless person, corporate executive, nurse, dishwasher, plumber, or farmer who ventures to trek down here on any given Tuesday has an undisputable right to be heard without fear of reprisal from the board chair or to be intimidated by a sheriff's deputy in the room waiting for a signal from the chair to escort that speaker from these chambers. Mr. Hill, you told Lindy that her, in your words, rude behavior was not helpful in advancing her cause. Although I don't agree that she was rude, I do want to explore the advancing your cause part of your comment. I would like you to tell us what would be helpful in advancing any cause with respect to the wastewater project. We have pointed out factual flaws throughout this project that eventually are corrected at some level of bureaucracy, but seldom without a redundant fight at these lecterns. Examples provided upon request, which I know you won't ask for. Why dredge up bad memories and embarrass staff or yourselves again? On other issues, we weren't even provided a courtesy response. Nitrate testing or an economic impact report are just two recent examples. To be truly representatives of your entire constituency, you must humble yourselves to the fact that you don't know everything and stop burying your heads in the sand when it comes to Los Osos. It's obvious that the New Times and Tribune have. The future of Los Osos will be much different than you have been led to believe. Thank you.
Ms. Walsh, followed by Al Barrow, please.
Jerry Walsh, Los Osos. Chairman Hill, I regret to inform you, you are not God sitting up there in judgment of those before you. Neither are you a judge presiding over a court deciding if something is slanderous or not. You are merely a public servant whose duty is to listen to those who speak to counsel you in your actions concerning them. You wrote, "Of course, so many vile things can be defended under the hazy banner of what's democratic." To that I say, "Of course, so many vile things can be shrouded under the hazy banner of what's civility." We heard about David Edge and Gail Wilcox ad nauseum for weeks on end as front page news, but you have put the royal kibosh on even mentioning the affair between Pava Ogren, County Public Works Director, and Maria Kelly, who was an elected official serving in the Los Osos CSD board. CalCostNews.com is a very reputable online news source whose recently deceased editor had even won a Pulitzer Prize. Karen Veely researches and digs into the facts. On August 11, 2011, she wrote a story titled Phone Records Debunk Public Officials, which Lindy Owen was attempting to read when you cut her mic off. I will quote from it now, but I won't be able to finish it. San Luis Obispo County phone records obtained by CalCoast News prove a personal relationship between a county official and a Los Osos board member began more than 4 years ago. County Public Works Director Pavo Ogren and former Los Osos Service District Board member Maria Kelly are being investigated by the county for a possible conflict of interest. The investigation was prompted by allegations the couple were involved in a close personal relationship while Kelly was voting on issues that impacted Ogren. Critics contend Ogren and Kelly failed to comply with closed session privacy laws, conflict of interest rules, residence laws, and ethic rules. In her defense, Kelly claims she had begun dating Ogren about 6 months ago, and they have never discussed issues regarding the sewer. Her former husband, Sean Kelly, said Ogren would tell Maria Kelly how she should vote on district issues before board meetings and would follow up with discussions over closed session meetings, a claim supported by Ogren's county cell phone records. These records show Ogren and Kelly spoke regularly from early 2007 through late 2009, when Ogren stopped using the county cell phone. Some calls lasted more than an hour, and many were made during the workday. For example, on January 2, 2009, Kelly called Ogren at 9 p.m., and they remained on the line for more than 2 hours, their third phone exchange that day. Critics claim that the relationship between Ogren and Kelly began before Kelly ran for office in 2008. I can't read the rest of this, but this is on CalCoastNews.com. Thank you.
Mr. Barrow, followed by Julie Tacker, please.
Good morning, board members. My name is Al Barrow, Coalition for Low-Income Housing. And I would like to see something up on the screen besides. This is, again, a map of the Los Osos Basin, the water basin. And this is an approximation by one of your consultants of the clay lens called A Horizon, which underlays all of these homes and septic tanks. But actually, it actually extends out Broderson, according to the cross-sectional maps, and goes down all the way around this area here. But the significance of that is I sent you a letter that was dated approximately September 2009 from Robert Pickney of Adenas, who stated in part of his letter that a clay lens would prevent pollution of nitrogen from entering the drinking water aquifer as it's perched. That's only one of four, horizon A, B, C, and D, below them. The likelihood of those waters reaching the groundwater supply is very unlikely. This area up here is this subdivision, about 400 home, is 60 feet above that first perch lens. So what the significance of this is that you're going to sewer an area that's high groundwater, that's in liquefaction conditions, that has a earthquake fault running along approximately this line out to two more faults. This fault is a 6.8 fault, three times the magnitude of the earthquake we experienced in 2003. It connects to the shoreline fault and the Hosgree fault that are offshore about 8 miles. And those have a potential for 7.6. The risk that you're entertaining with the gravity sewer is a $200 million investment. If there is a quake, it's very likely that this community would be very little value, that it wouldn't pay the debt That's a 40-year debt. Very high likelihood that there will be a quake, and it's all high liquefaction zone. So I just submit to you, please read the letter that I sent to you from Bob Pickney again, carefully. He has 8 points in that letter, and have a great week.
Thank you, Mr. Barrow. Ms. Tacker, followed by Martha Golden, please.
Good morning. I am Julie Tacker from Los Osos. And my first question is, while it is your prerogative, Chairman Hill, I don't know why you shuffle the speaker slips. In many boards and government agencies, it is somewhat customary that speaker slips that come in are served first come, first serve. The reason I came today was first to suggest that you owe Lindy Owen an apology. You suggested that her speech, her reading of news articles at the podium last week, was a personal attack on someone on your staff. You even went so far as to cut off the microphone, which I believe is a violation of your contract with your video provider. That is a gavel-to-gavel coverage provider, and to cut off a speaker's mic, I believe, is protected. I'm not sure you know what a personal attack is. When I went to your rules of procedure, last updated in June of 08, it makes mention of slanderous or profane remarks against any individual. It does not speak to personal attack or what the definition of that is. But I think you're very capable of levying a personal attack, and I heard you do it, suggesting that one of the speakers that came some months ago, that perhaps your board sell his certified assistance dog. I believe you owe him an apology as well. I did come also with some unfinished business. We were here on September 20th for what I called an update of the Los Osos Wastewater Project. Nearly $200 million project really does need a lot of eyes and ears focused on it, including yours. So I would have preferred a more expanded update, but here we are a month or so later, and the website hasn't been updated with anything since August. Mr. Gibson helped Mr. Waddell answer the question of whether or not we were on deadline with several of the permits and the conditions of approval. Those items, if we're meeting those deadlines, are not being loaded on that website. If we had that information, maybe we wouldn't come here week after week. I think, again, you owe Ms. Owen an apology, and you wouldn't have gotten a public beating on the Brown Act or the First Amendment today if you'd just kept your hands off the microphone.
Martha Golden, followed by Leon Golden, please.
Good morning. Martha Golden, Los Osos. I'm here today because of my deep concern for the standing of the First Amendment in this chamber. As you know, I am a retired lawyer. I am a retired judge. In a prior life, when I was an attorney, my principal work was an appellate attorney on cases involving the First Amendment. So I think I have a little familiarity, but apparently the members of this board, and that includes not just the board members but county council, have either not bothered with the First Amendment at all or have forgotten what it's all about, and certainly have not considered the case interpretation. You've heard plenty about the Brown Act. Now I want to help you a little bit with the interpretation of the First Amendment as interpreted by that strange institution way over there in Washington, D.C., the United States Supreme Court, which 40 years ago had a very interesting case before it and which it decided. And I just want to quote a little bit from that case, starting with the facts as announced by Justice Harlan, who wrote the majority opinion. Appellant Paul Robert Cohen was convicted of violating the penal code in California. I skipped a few words here. This is a direct quote from the opinion of the court. Quote, "The facts upon which his conviction rests are detailed in the opinion of the Court of Appeal, Second Appellate District, as follows. On April 26, 1968, the defendant was observed in the Los Angeles County Courthouse in the corridor outside of Division 20 of the Municipal Court wearing a jacket bearing the words, 'Fuck the draft,' which were plainly visible." End of the quotation. Now, the court goes on to analyze the right of the municipality of Los Angeles to arrest and convict this man and concludes that it was a violation of the First Amendment. And it took them not a very long opinion, 7 or 8 pages, to get around to all of the explanations for why. I commend to you reading the case to understand that the words spoken here are not a violation of decorum or anything that entitles you to shut off mics, to have the sheriff escort people out of the chambers. Thank you.
Mr. Golden?
Well, I, too, want to join with Julie Tacker's complaint. Why don't you take speakers as their slips are passed? And is this some sort of? I always end up being after my wife or before my wife. Anyway,
you should.
Can I have some? I'd be happy to expound at that. Can I have some time to do that? Well, you know, I turn in my slip before other speakers, and I'm being called after them. You arrange the order in which people speak. That's wrong, okay? I hope that stops. In any case, I also want to join with all the people who have dealt with the First Amendment in this situation. I, too, have had considerable experience as a lawyer in the area of First Amendment. And although your body does not have the requirements that are placed upon courts to not only do justice, but have the appearance of justice, I think that there is a duty on your part to have the appearance of fairness. And that doesn't always come through the work that we see here. For example, there's a lot of feeling out in the community, not only in Los Osos, but throughout the county, that supervisors watch out for other supervisors. If it's in District 3, then, well, you know, okay, I'll go along with that, because when something happens in my district, we hope that the supervisor will go along with my project. The appearance of fairness is very important, just as important as the other issues that have been raised here this morning. And what is needed desperately is a thorough investigation of the entire sewer project. And I mean that you need to have somebody look and see what happened to those millions of dollars, why they had to be spent. What kind of qualifications did the people who were running this have? Were they really ever done anything like build a sewer? Certainly not from what we've been shown here. I remember, been a couple of years ago, or maybe it was 3, when we had a shovel-ready project. And I'm afraid this, unless something different happens,
The money that you expect to get from the federal government will not be forthcoming, and saltwater intrusion will continue to work its way to destroying the entity that's called Los Osos.
That will conclude public comment. Madam Clerk, can you introduce the first item of board business, please?
B1, consideration of a resolution of intent to participate in the Great California Shakeout.
Okay. Mr. Grant, are you? Do we see anybody here that's going to shake out besides people leaving?
Well, Jim Grant, County Administrator. We do have Ron Alsop. He was here a moment ago.
Ron, are you listening?
If your board wants to take a five-minute break, that
we will take a five-minute break and we'll Ron back
put it all
in here.
Together.
All right.
Thank you.
Great. 5 minutes. We're back. If you could, just so we could remind our audience, Madam Clerk, introduce the first business item. Reintroduce that, rather.
Item D1, consideration of a resolution of intent to participate in the Great California Shakeout.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Alsop, who was hiding under a desk and demonstrating to many people.
Not hiding.
He
Mr.
Was,
Chairman.
Practice. Well, what would the word be? He was being safe.
Well, my apologies for being too safe and not getting out from under the desk quickly enough. excuse me. We're here today asking for you to approve a resolution of intent to participate in the Great California Shakeout Earthquake Preparedness Event. However, our item actually goes beyond requesting your permission to participate. Specifically, we're asking you to, in our case, for county employees to participate on Thursday, October 20th at 10:20 a.m. There will be a statewide earthquake drill called the Great California Shakeout. In addition to encouraging members of the public to participate, of which over 40,000 people have signed up in San Luis Obispo County to participate in the Great California Shakeout, as well as 8.4 million statewide, in particular, for our item here, we're asking your approval for this resolution, and the intent being to encourage all county departments to participate in the exercise we do have scheduled for October 20th at 10:20 a.m. We're all through the safety representatives in each county department. County employees will be participating in the drill, the Great Shakeout Drill, and practicing drop, cover, and hold on. In addition to the county, Superior Court has also signed up to officially participate. Our building co-hosts across the street. However, this is more than a drop, cover, and hold on exercise. And as we all know, when the shaking starts, a lot of damage occurs within buildings, things falling, things flying around due to the shaking. So we do want to practice the drop, cover, and hold on. But more than that is a what next. And in particular, for county government, part of the drill on Thursday is going to be now what? Simulate electricity being out. So many of us might remember after the San Simeon earthquake, cell phones didn't work initially. So it's more than a practice taking cover. It's a what are you going to do next type of exercise. And with that, we're going to play a little quick one-minute video here. And then Mike and I are actually going to simulate that cover and hold as soon as the video is done. And we encourage anyone in the audience, as well as anyone else that wants to participate, to actually practice the drop covering and holding on. In the past, we're all familiar with, well, I don't have the drop cover and hold on under a table, and obviously there aren't a lot of tables in here, but it's also a lot of common sense stuff. And in here, get in between the chairs and protect your head and neck. And with that, Mike, if we can start the video.
This is the Great California Shakeout. You're joining millions of Californians in the largest earthquake drill in U.S. history. Practice now so you can protect yourself during a real earthquake. This is an earthquake drill. Right now, drop, cover, and hold on. Unless you're driving, drop to the ground now. If you're standing during a large earthquake, the ground might jerk strongly and throw you down. Take cover under something sturdy to protect yourself from objects being hurled across the room. Hold on to it until the shaking stops. If you can't get under something, stay low and protect your head and neck with your arms. Now, look around. What objects might fall or be thrown at you in an earthquake that you should secure in place now? Finally, strong earthquakes may trigger tsunami. If you're near the beach during an earthquake, drop cover and hold on, then walk quickly to high ground when the shaking stops. This drill is over. Visit shakeout.org for simple steps to help you survive and recover from a major earthquake, including how to secure your space. Thank you for taking part in the Great California Shakeout.
And as Mike and I will demonstrate, you know, it's a simple matter of getting down under a desk, taking hold, and holding on. You want to hold on when the shaking stops, especially if you're under a table. You don't want the table to scoot away from you. So with that. All right. And stay down until the shaking stops. Thank you, Mike. The shaking has stopped. Thank you, Chairperson Hill, that certainly added to it. And now sometimes we take this, it's a fun thing, but I want to remember seriously that even in our own county, and we've unfortunately had the experience of two fatalities, as well as a number of injuries after the San Simeon earthquake. So it's a fun little drill, but it's a serious thing. We really do need to know what to do during and after an earthquake. And I'll close with reminding folks that there's some really good information on the website. Shakeout.org. Again, Ron, shakeout.org.
Ron, a couple of questions, and one that came up from the video. So what do you do if you're in a car? Since it said, well, don't do this if you're in a car, which makes sense. But obviously earthquakes occur while people are in their car, so what should they do?
Well, if you pull over into a safe area, don't get under a power lines or similar to being in a building. You don't want to expose yourself to a danger. So just pull over to the road if you safely can.
Okay. Mr. Gibson?
To the side of the road, rather.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can report that the space immediately by my knees at the dais works very, very nicely, and I managed to get in and more importantly, out. The Great American Shakeout's been going for a number of years now, and, I always thought the drop, cover, and hold drill, frankly, that was sort of funny in a way. But in talking to the folks who have organized it, they make a very important point. One of them is that within the anxiety of an earthquake, it's good to have a plan as to what where you want to do. And as I reflect, in 1971, I was in college in Los Angeles when the Sylmar earthquake shook, and I was out the door. In a building that had red clay tile roof. And, thinking back on that probably wasn't the smartest move. So the idea where it seems a little odd to go under your desk, I think it's a good, it's something to might just stick in the back of your mind. I think the exercise also opens up the conversation for earthquake preparedness in general, which I think is a really good subject for us, especially in this county, that we have the proper equipment on hand, the proper supplies on hand, the idea that we need to survive a 72-hour period, perhaps, after an earthquake. With that, I'd be pleased to move approval of the resolution authorizing the county to participate.
Open up to the public. I have no request to speak on this item, so I'll bring it back. Mr. Gibson's made a motion. Is there a second from Supervisor Meacham? Roll call, please, Madam Clerk. Or is
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
And Mr. Hill?
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Mike. All right. We are moving on to our health agency item. Madam Clerk, if you would introduce that, please.
E1, consideration of a request to, 1, approve a replacement agreement with the Community Health Centers of the Central Coast for fiscal years 2011-12 and 2012-13 in the amounts of $2,540,000 and $2,500,000, respectively, to provide primary medical care, pharmacy, and auxiliary services to the County Medical Services Program patients, and authorize a corresponding budget adjustment in the amount of $440,000 from general fund contingencies.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. Mr. Grant, would you like to kick off this item?
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Grant, County Administrator. You may recall during the budget hearings that we had in June that there was a discussion regarding the the contract with community health centers of the Central Coast. And there was no resolution at that point. It was kicked back to staff to go negotiate with CHC to come up with a contract to provide medical services to our most needy. I'm pleased to say that that the health agency staff has negotiated a two-year contract with CHC that maintains the medical services that to our needy that is consistent with what we've been providing in the past. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Health Agency Director Jeff Hamm to give you the details. Jeff?
Thank you, Mr. Grant. Good morning, board members. Jeff Hamm, Health Agency Director. As Jim mentioned, this recent budget development process, fourth year in a row that the county has struggled to bridge a financial gap. Health agencies played a significant role in that process, as you know. This is the fourth year of what had been a five-year agreement with community health centers for medical care services to the CMSP and other low-income populations of the county, and had a $3 million grant amount embedded in the agreement. The final budget was adopted with $2.2 million, reflecting the fact that there was $800,000 of our cuts, of the health agency's cut list, associated with this particular aspect of the health agency's service delivery mix. So as soon as the budget was adopted, we began working with CHC representatives to see if we could find a way to sort of bridge that gap and come to a replacement agreement. I'm very pleased to be here to recommend your approval of the agreement that's before you today. Frankly, a big part of the reason that we were able to be successful in those negotiations had to do with the excellent job all of the department heads and we did watching our pennies last year, which contributed in part at least to a healthy fund balance available against the assumptions that were made when the budget was adopted. That and other factors, I think, allowed conversations between Mr. Grant and myself to result in the second action that's before you today, which is a recommended transfer from general fund contingencies to increase our expense appropriation level by $440,000. Clearly, it would have been a much more difficult process had that not been a component of what I'm here recommending before you today. There was also on CHC's part, very serious consideration in inclusion of some changes in their mode of operation in terms of some of their labor costs and some other aspects of them tightening their belt, so to speak. So I won't go into that in any more detail. There was a summary of that in the staff report. But the two principal components of the agreement before you worth mentioning, I think, are that the agreement has historically, since 2004, included a requirement that they provide limited three different areas of specialty care that were areas that the county had included in its family care center primary care clinic network at the time we handed the keys to our clinics over to CHC back in 2004. So we required them to maintain limited capacity hours per week of neurological care, orthopedic care, and cardiology. Those three specialties are now excluded from the scope of the agreement with CHC. We have specialists that were providing those services that will continue to provide them on referral from the primary care providers in the CHC network. We'll just pay them directly instead of paying CHC to pay them. And so $100,000 of the reduced scope of the agreement will be costs that we'll incur in our CMSP program for those three specialty care services. So the $440,000 appropriation transfer or budget adjustment that's part of the recommendation today will provide $340,000 that will add to the 2.2 in the budget to come up with the grant amount for the current fiscal year at $2,540,000. $40,000 of that amount represents a delay in the agreement that was reached that required that CHC make some changes. So essentially we're recognizing that we should pay a slightly higher amount for the first couple months of the fiscal year, recognizing that it took some time for them to implement some of their cost reduction strategies that they've chosen to implement. And then in the second year of this replacement agreement, or the fifth year of the five-year term, the grant amount is set at $2.5 million. So when I'm feeling very optimistic. It's nice to think that we won't be having this conversation with them again as we go into the 12-13 budget. I'd like to think that about a lot of the programs that we're responsible for administering. Thank you. But there obviously are no guarantees, so it's our hope that we'll be able to ride this year and the fifth year of the agreement through without the need for a repeat of these kind of negotiations. So that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hamm. Supervisor Patterson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask you if you'd detail how the agreement that was presented, the funding recommendation of $2.2 million that was recommended during the budget hearings had changed and what the current agreement details are, and you articulated that. I wanted to ask you, one of the issues that we've grappled with over the past years in determining exactly what to budget for this care with CHC, we had a lack of information forthcoming from CHC, and they had agreed to provide that information, and I'm wondering if you were successful in getting more cooperation and more detail from CHC in these later negotiations and getting the data you needed to really come up with these new recommendations.
We did have success in those discussions with CHC representatives. They responded to the questions that we asked. Now, one of the things that we did not get into a lot of detail on were the individual financial characteristics or the financial characteristics of individual clinics. With our compromise essentially coming to the table with more money than the $2.2 million, they indicated that it would not be necessary for them to require that we agree to allow them to reduce clinic services in the North Coast or in other of the six clinics that are specified in the agreement. So we didn't pursue the detailed analysis that might have required.
Okay, and
but
so
short of that,
they did claim that if they didn't get more than the $2.2 million, they would have to close clinics. So there will be no clinic closure as a result of this latest agreement. Is that correct?
Well, they aren't proposing that. The agreement continues to require that they keep those clinics open and that they maintain the hours that the agreement requires. But there has always been a caveat in the agreement that should things change, they would have an opportunity to submit a proposal to us that we would, of course, consider in a good faith fashion as we would with any contractor providing services. So I'm hopeful, and I know they are hopeful, that those conversations won't need to occur during the term of this agreement, but there's no guarantees.
Okay. Thank you.
I have no further questions, Mr. Hamm, so I will open up the public. I have one request to speak. Mike Brown, please. Do you have I'm sorry, Eric. Yes, and followed by Eric Greening. I'm sorry.
Mike Brown representing CoLab. We have no problem with the substance of this item. Health care for poor people is a basic primary function of county government, but we think it is illustrative of the broader policy issues that need attention. So with the normal rules of the budget process and the 5 or 7 year pain plan, they would have gotten a $2.2 million, which obviously wasn't enough. And the reason you're struggling is your property tax is down, your sales tax is flat, your TOT is flat, and this is likely to continue. And last week you discussed the types of gaps and contingencies, which, as the county administrator said, could render things very precarious. But the real underlying issue is the county's financial position resulting from the recession. You simply don't have enough money to fund all the basic services in a manner that you think you should. So once again, we think that you really ought to look at what you're doing to try and take control of the situation to the extent you can at the local level. And so once again, we point out that you need to declare a moratorium on further regulations. Secondly, and once again, you need to roll back some of the onerous regulations like the Smart Growth Plan, the Level 3 water prohibitions in the North County, and the new TDC mandate in its mandated version. And then you need to really implement some major economic stabilization programs and use the wealth of the county, its skilled workforce and leaders, to see what you can do to stimulate things. And you need to make that a priority of the bureaucracy. Rewards and sanctions should be, well, what are you getting done out there? What are you getting built? What's the velocity on these permits? And cease all these proposed regulations, both here and in some of the derivative commissions like the Waste Authority and the APCD. And finally, groups such as CHC's patients, your labor groups, and everybody else that's affected needs to mobilize and see that this change needs to be made. Thank you very much.
Eric?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I was very grateful last week to hear you discussing something that I've been advocating for some time, which is that the health department budget be considered a public safety budget. You're obviously wrestling with that question. Lives are saved. Deaths are prevented. If that isn't public safety, I don't know what is. I'm grateful that we're not at the barest of the bare minimums we were going to be. I'm still wondering whether this is the level of support that this service would be getting if you were truly considering this as part of our public safety budget. I want to be sure that you are sure and can knowledgeably be sure, for example, that no one in this county will hesitate to receive care if that, in terms of access to care, in terms of availability of care, in the event that their decision whether to look for it or not might prevent an epidemic or allow an epidemic to happen. The costs of an epidemic are far greater than the amounts we're discussing here. Being a grateful user of the First Amendment, when I hear points made that I disagree with, I'm grateful to have the opportunity to state my own views. I don't believe that either the groundwater management plan for the Paso Robles Basin or the strategic growth principles represent any threat to the availability of funding for the health department. I think the greatest threat, quite honestly, is the failure to find a way to get road users to pay for the roads rather than having that come out of the general fund. If that particular stream could be liberated by being the responsibility being taken, then I think we could truly dispense with all questions as to whether this is an adequate maintenance of effort. I do have one question. When the Paso Robles Mental Health Clinic was closed and presumably the service consolidated in Atascadero, I would just like to know whether it's the opinion of the people who know that all those who were receiving service still have access to service and still have transportation to service in the new location. This is the kind of juggling we're going to continue to be doing. We are still left with the open question of whether they will come back with further consolidations, closures, limitations of hours. We simply are not guaranteed a level of service, but I do appreciate finding the money from contingencies to at least keep the worst disaster from happening. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. That will close it to public comment. I will bring it back to the board and see if there's any further questions. If not, how about a motion?
Move staff's recommendation.
I'll second.
Okay. Moved by Supervisor Gibson, seconded by Supervisor Patterson. Roll call, Madam Clerk, please.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
And Mr. Hill?
Yes, thank you. And if you, while you have your microphone there, if you could introduce this next item, please.
Item F1, consideration of 1, a resolution authorizing submittal of a grant application in the amount of $958,730 to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development for the 2011 Federal Supportive Housing Program, and 2, a request to authorize the Director of Planning and Building to sign the standard agreement and execute necessary documents to implement programs if the application is approved.
Thank you. Before we begin, in order to exercise an abundance of caution and any perception of conflict, I'm going to recuse myself on this item and let Supervisor Patterson chair this item, and I'll be back on the next one. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to do that. Ms. Terrell, would you present the staff report, please?
Thank you. Morgan Terrell, planning staff. This is a request to submit an application to the Department of Housing and Urban Development in the amount of $958,730 to assist homeless persons with supportive services, transitional and supportive housing with case management, and the Homeless Management Information System in the 2012 to 2013 program year. The purpose that the federal government states is to assist homeless individuals and families in transitioning to self-sufficiency and permanent housing. The grants are applied for annually. They're competitive. However, if existing grants are renewed, then they go into a non-competitive pool and are automatically funded. This particular request is to renew 5 existing grants totaling $848,467 and 1 new grant for $110,263 for a permanent housing project. Here's a quick review of the time frame. There was a notice of funding availability released in August, and then the county submitted or released a request for proposals. A group met and reviewed the applications, and I will go over that at the end with their recommendation. And the application is due October 28th to the federal government. I will just briefly touch on the 5 renewals right now. The first project is a transitional housing and case management project in the city of San Luis Obispo. It's run by Transitions Mental Health Association and Community Action Partnership. There's 20 beds, and many more people are case managed than those 20 individuals. And there are 2 permanent housing grants, both in the North County and a few units also in Los Osos. And the first one is $55,000, and Transitions Mental Health houses 10 individuals. And the second one is $48,091, and Community Action Partnership houses 6 individuals in Atascadero. There's a supportive services grant in the South County. It provides just general case management services, and then the county proposes to renew its homeless management information system grant. And then the new proposal is it's called a bonus project. It's a permanent housing project that will serve 11 beds. You'll note a slight change from your staff report. The initial application was to serve 10 individuals in the North County, and a small decision-making group that reviewed the applications requested that a family of 3 be served, so it would be 8 individuals in a family of 3 instead of 10 individuals. So that brings the total to 11. And there would be a set-aside for 5 beds for chronically homeless individuals. And the proposal right now is that 2 beds are also set aside for veterans. The initial proposal was for 1 veteran, and that decision-making group also requested that 2 veterans be targeted. So the Transitions Mental Health agreed to that, and they're here today if there's any questions. So the little decision-making group, or it's an application review committee, really is a little subcommittee of the Homeless Services Oversight Council. It was created especially to review these applications, and in subsequent years, this setup will be the same, and the entire Homeless Services Oversight Council will hopefully also review these applications in the future, if time allows. The group recommends submittal of the proposed applications with the changes we discussed with the additional veterans and the family, and staff recommends that your board adopt the attached resolution authorizing the Planning and Building Director to submit an application to HUD and to sign it. The agreement and execute all necessary documents. This concludes my presentation, and I'm available for questions, as well as I mentioned Transitions Mental Health.
Okay. Very good, Mr. Rell. Thank you. Are there any questions among my colleagues? Seeing none, I do have a couple. Mr. Rell, the new grant that's being proposed and submitted, that is a competitive grant, whereas the others, and that's number six on the list, the others are basically renewals of existing programs. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And there's very little opportunity to modify those without subjecting them to a competitive pool as well, as I understand?
That's correct. If you so the federal government has different requirements every year. They change. But this year, an existing project can only be reallocated to a permanent supportive housing project without becoming competitive. And if other projects, like a case management grant, if it's only supportive services, we go into a competitive pool. And if you're not awarded funds, then the program is lost. No program will be funded. You lose the money.
And basically then, the enumeration study that was recently conducted illustrating the homeless population in the county did show a high number of veterans are included in that homeless population, as well as an increasing number of families. And I'm assuming that you're constrained by the HUD criteria when you renew these grants and when you apply for new grants. And I'm also assuming that the HSOC subcommittee that reviews these grants know what our greatest needs are, and they try to work within the HUD criteria to fill those gaps. And we're simply, again, constrained by the HUD criteria and can only maneuver within what their criteria is.
Right. There are there's some requirements. For example, the new project has to be a permanent supportive housing grant for persons with disabilities. So there's a restriction there. Everyone has to be homeless and disabled. There's a little bit of wiggle room about whether it serves individuals or families. However, Transitions Mental Health, my understanding is that they focus mostly on homeless individuals rather than families, but they are willing to partner with other agencies to serve a family and to try it. And the subcommittee of the HSOC are aware of the needs in the data that's available about homeless people served and the enumeration.
Very good. Well, thank you for that. And I do want to point out that Jill Bolster-White and other representatives from Transitions Mental Health Association are here. They're partners. And I also want to thank the HSOC committee and reviewing these grants and making these recommendations. I will open it to the public for comments. I have no request to speak from the public, so I'll close it to public comment and bring it back to the board. Do I have a motion?
Yep. Mr. Chairman, I'd be pleased to move staff's recommendation on this.
Very good. Second? It's been moved by Supervisor Gibson, seconded by Supervisor Teixeira to approve staff's recommendation.
My thanks to the folks who work on this and to the groups that carry out these programs. I'm particularly heartened as I see our renewals being a lot involved with case management, which is great for the people that are served and cost-effective use of our funds.
Absolutely, and I'm also pleased to note that one of the requests is to continue our homeless service, the homeless management information system, which gives us the data we need to really be able to apply for these grants in a meaningful way and meet the needs of the homeless population here in San Luis Obispo County. So with that, Madam Clerk, a roll call, please.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
And Mr. Patterson?
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much. And with that, we have one more. You want to go ahead and take a break now? We'll take a 15-minute break and return at 10:45.
You're live.
All right. Thank you, Madam Clerk. We're back in session, and we have our hearing item here for the morning. C1, could you please introduce that?
C1, a hearing to consider a request from the Cambria Community Services District to waive a portion of the development plan processing fees for the Fiscalini Ranch Park, 2nd District.
Okay. Mr. Jansen's here, I see, so we'll turn it over to him.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board, Matt Jansen, planning staff.
As the clerk just noted, this is a fee waiver request. And to make a long story short, because Cambria CSD has been working on this project for a good long time, we've recently received a development plan application for the park. And although staff feels that the park and the project qualifies for an entire fee waiver, we negotiated a settlement, if you will, with the CSD in that they would pay a portion of those fees. And the fees that we want paid specifically are the fees that we'll be using to spend time coordinating with the Coastal Commission, I'll put it that way. And also there's another fee that has to do with environmental health review of the project. But the remainder of the fees, $10,071 of the $12,079, we feel we're recommending be waived. And so that would conclude my presentation.
Okay, great. Thank you. A question from, I see, Mr. Patterson.
Yes. Mr. Jansen, I'm just curious, what is the fee for the health department? Is there a well on site, or what's planned that they're involved in terms of their review, permit review?
I'm thinking that Mr. Foote could probably answer the question better, but it's a standard health fee that we've attached to the development plan to make sure that that water services, if provided, and wastewater, if going to be treated on site or otherwise, are dealt with appropriately. So it's a standard fee that we attach.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Why don't we go to the public, and we do have a request from Mr. Foote. David Foote, please.
Morning, Mr. Chair and board members. David Foote with Firma representing the district. Jerry Gruber, the interim manager, couldn't be here today. But I don't want to take your time, but I can answer any questions you might have about the long process and the project. We're just anxious to get this hurdle and then get it processed and let the Coastal Commission have a look at it. Great. So any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Foote. Mm-hmm. I see no questions, so we appreciate you being here. And I will close it to public comment unless Councilmember Strong has a inkling. He seems to be unusually reserved, though we're happy to have him.
I think he's interested, though, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, he is interested.
And
so with that, I'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board, and let the supervisor of the district, Mr. Gibson,
Mr. Chairman. Appreciate staff's work with the district. This eventually, I think, will be a wonderful public amenity, and I will move staff's recommendation on the fee waiver.
Second?
I'll second.
Okay. Mr. Patterson seconds. With no further comment, a roll call, Madam Clerk, with Mr. Gibson motion and Mr. Patterson second.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
And Mr. Hill?
Yes. Okay, great. Thank you very much. That was very swift. Very swift. That brings us to our closed session. We do not have any speaker requests because the chambers are about to empty. So I will go to our county council for a time estimate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Warren Jensen, county council. About 30 minutes.
Okay. We will recess until 1:30, and we will be back with some exciting afternoon hearings. Thank you.
Good afternoon, and thanks for being here for our afternoon session. I see our esteemed county council jogging to give his report out of closed session. He's so excited about it. Mr. Jensen.
Thank you. Sorry to keep you waiting. Warren Jensen, the county council. The board did meet in closed session. No reportable action was taken.
Thank you. Were you being buttonholed by Mr. Green? Was that it?
Yes.
I saw that. All right. I would love a motion on our presentation calendar.
So moved.
Okay. Moved by Supervisor Patterson, second by Supervisor Teixeira. Roll call, Madam Clerk.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Sure.
I missed someone, huh?
Yeah, that would be me, Madam Clerk. But I won't mess it up. I'll vote yes, too.
I think that was unanimous on the presentation. We'll just record it as so. All right. We'll begin with National Friends of the Library Week, which we're very excited about. We see many of our friends of the library here. And Supervisor Patterson is going to read the proclamation, if our librarians and friends of libraries would come to the lectern, please. Let's see, Mr. Reynolds.
Yes.
We have
all sorts of...
We have copies of the proclamation for all of our friends groups, so please come forward. May I?
Okay. Please.
It gives me great pleasure to read this proclamation recognizing the week of October 16th to 22nd, 2011, as National Friends of the Library Week. The following resolution is hereby offered in red. Whereas Friends of the Library groups countywide provide funding, advocacy, and time to support and expand library services by providing additional resources for programming, equipment, support for children's summer reading, and special events throughout the year, as well as additional books and materials for library users. And whereas the work of the Friends of the Library takes place countywide with Friends of the Library groups located in Arroyo Grande, Atascadero, Cambria, Cayucas, Creston, Grover Beach, Los Osos, Morro Bay, Napomo, Oceano, Paso Robles, San Luis Obispo, Santa Margarita, Shell Beach, and Templeton. And whereas the Friends of the Library understand the critical importance of a well-funded library system and advocate to ensure that our library receives the resources it needs to provide a wide variety of services to all ages, including access to print and electronic materials, along with expert assistance in research, readers advisory, and children's services. And whereas the Friends' gift of their time and commitment to the library sets an example for all in how volunteerism leads to positive civic engagement and the betterment of our communities. Now, therefore, be it resolved and ordered that the Board of Supervisors does hereby proclaim the week of October 16th to 22nd, 2011, as National Friends of the Library Week, and urges everyone to join the Friends of the Libraries and thank them for all they do to make county libraries and communities so much better.
Come up and receive. Maybe they could sort them out.
We'll let you folks
tell us where you're from. Know all of you. Cambria, great. Thank you for being here. Castro,
hey, Barbara. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Morabe, good to see you.
You know where you are.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Hey, Lily. Good to see you.
Appreciate it.
Are they all?
Oh, are they all sorted?
No, we just give them.
They're all the same.
But, I mean, they have their names.
I don't think so.
I think they're all the same.
Okay. We have proclamations for all of our friends of the library, so I wanted to make sure they weren't
something else.
Different names or something else. So. Did you want
Would you say a few words?
Brian Reynolds, Library Director, here with Assistant Library Director Margaret Esther.
I think all of us can agree that public libraries are one of the most important services government provides. We clearly could not do that, even in the best of times, without our stalwart friends of the library groups, which we have representation today, not only from our own county library system, but from Grover Beach, the Volunteer Library, and also from Paso Robles. So it's a united front. We love books, we love libraries, and we're grateful for your support. Thank you.
And was Margaret going to say? Okay, good.
And I will say not only thank you, but thank you to all of our friends, and thank you to all of the folks who walk into the libraries every day that we're open in every public library. This morning I heard somebody talking about First Amendment, and I almost stopped and I went, yes, come to the public library. So
I almost said the same thing.
Thank you. We saw the same person on the same street corner. Thank you, gentlemen. Margaret Esther, Assistant Library Director, and I will see to it that all of our fringe groups get these.
Thank you, Margaret. Mr. Chair, if I may, just to comment, we're so proud here at the Board of Supervisors because while so many counties are closing libraries and cutting back on their staffing and their hours and services available to the public, in San Luis Obispo, we're busy building two new libraries. And I think that illustrates the commitment of this board and the county and the library, as well as the public and all of our friends at the library. We've got a new one underway in Cambria, as well as one in Atascadero, and we're all extremely proud of that. And I was remiss in not wearing my Library Foundation T-shirt today, but I can share what it says. It says, libraries, not just books, it's our future. So thank you all for being here.
Here's to that, and Mr. Chairman, if I might be indulged, I've not found another community organization as constructive and as passionate about their mission as the Friends of the Library group. They've undertaken huge challenges in all our communities. They've gone the extra mile and doing everything from providing extra hours to taking on million-dollar construction deals, and I just can't thank them enough for what they do.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I again, besides the libraries in our system, it's great. I've had the pleasure of working with Barbara Nichols and some of the other folks in the Grover Beach Library, which is a volunteer library in the community. They've done a terrific job, and it's become a real important part of the community in Grover Beach. And I know wherever those libraries do prop up, that's what happens. So thank you so much for being here.
And if I may just quickly, Mr. Chair, the Atascadero Friends of the Library this Sunday, October 23rd, is having an open house and major donor recognition event at the new library site on Capistrano from 2 to 4 p.m., and you're all welcome. Please do come.
Thank okay. you. All right, we're moving on to the Beach Tractors, which was a successful entry into the recent Sunset Savor Festival, and because it occurred in District 2, and Supervisor Gibson is proud to be able to. If the folks who are involved in the Beach Tractors, I see Mr. Diodati, I don't know how many of your neighbors and friends, if they would come to the lectern, and Mr. Gibson will be happy to honor you with the proclamation.
Happy and beyond proud, Mr. Chairman. This group, as you can see by the energy evidenced here in chambers, is truly extraordinary. And I'm pleased to read the resolution recognizing the Beach Tractors. I'll let them explain where they got their name for winning Sunset's Magazine One Block Party Contest. Whereas, in March 2011, Sunset Magazine challenged their readership through a nationwide contest to plant, grow, raise, and produce as much food as possible from their neighborhood and throw a party featuring the locally raised food products. And whereas after receiving hundreds of applications from across the nation, Sunset selected 10 neighborhoods ranging from Colorado to Washington to California, including one neighborhood from Morro Bay. And whereas the 8 young families selected from Morro Bay living in the old Beach Tract development named themselves the Beach Tractors and set off on an adventure they will never forget. And whereas the families committed to educating their children about food production, highlighting the food resources found in Morro Bay, positively promoting Morro Bay, and all the while staying friends after the summer was over, and no small feat. And whereas, through fog, gale force winds, and even two unusual summer rain stories, welcome to District 2, the beach tractors forged ahead, growing and raising enough food to throw not only one party, but two parallel feasts, one for children, which was the better one, I bet, and one for adults. And whereas the beach tractors were kept extremely busy balancing other family events in order to raise and milk 4 goats, 9 Cornish cross meat hens, 8 egg-laying hens, and 700 oysters in Morro Bay, growing unusual backyard garden crops such as wheat, barley, sugar beets, and sugar cane, and, of course, the staples such as carrot, lettuce, tomatoes, corn, potatoes, you know, onions, garlic, cilantro, pepper, squash, and peas. And whereas on October 2nd, 2011, Sunset Food editor Margot True and editor-in-chief Katie Tammany announced during the Savor the Central Coast extravaganza held at Santa Margarita Ranch that the beach tractors had won the nationwide contest. And whereas Sunset Magazine, in announcing the beach tractors as winners, acknowledged, quote, their steep learning curve, their courage plunging ahead despite lack of knowledge, their camaraderie, their devotion to their kids' learning about where food comes from, and for the way in which they transformed their entire neighborhood in Morro Bay. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the County of San Luis Obispo Board of Supervisors does hereby recognize the beach tractors for winning Sunset Magazine's One Block Party contest and commends them for their energy in achieving an extraordinary vision of the possibilities of truly local food production. And if all would come forward, we would be pleased.
I can give a very good. I encourage you all to come forward to,
come
to receive.
Thank you. Congratulations.
Our pleasure. Oh, it's so much our pleasure.
Congratulations.
Good job.
Wish
you
the hard work.
Good job.
Congratulations.
Way to go.
Good job.
Nice work.
Aye, thank you.
What's your favorite? Nice work.
Good job. Yeah.
Congratulations.
We're going to get a. We have the paparazzi are here, so
if you want to come back,
if the tractors would.
Congratulations.
All right, let's squeeze in for a nice group photo of the friendly neighborhood.
I'm curious about the beach tractors. What does a beach tractor sound like? They don't have noises.
What was your favorite thing to grow, Liam?
My favorite thing to grow is broccoli.
Broccoli.
Yeah,
right. Broccoli.
Go one at a time.
I love big tractor.
You love the beach tractor.
My favorite thing was feeding the goats kale.
I like that.
I really like planting the carrots. We didn't really know. We knew each other, but not very well. And the contest helped us get to know each other better.
Great.
As the oldest one, I liked seeing how all the little kids did their gardening and how different it was from, like, bigger kids. So funny, yeah.
Thank you, Chairman Hill and members of the board, and thank you, District 2 Supervisor Bruce Gibson, for recognizing our neighborhood and the achievement that we accomplished this summer that showcased the distinct characters of your coastal district. As described in the resolution, I think Sunset Magazine really captured the essence of why we won this summer, because we were novice gardeners. We employed the strategy of ignorance is bliss and jumped into just about everything you could think of, including the farming of 700 oysters in the bay, which required us to go out there twice a week and shake them, get out in the water and shake them and make them big. And we also made it a priority for these children to learn about food production and about community and neighborhoods, because that, to us, win or lose, was what we wanted them to get out of this and take with them for the rest of their lives. And finally, as Sunset mentioned, the emphasis of community. We wanted to showcase Morro Bay, the businesses in Morro Bay, what it had to offer, working with Morro Bay Oyster Company to grow the oysters, and then looking into our own neighborhood and taking the experience of the wise and elderly in there that had some of these people, they've done this their whole lives as children, and it had been lost in a generation. They're so happy to share these experiences with us because we were so enthusiastic to learn it. So on behalf of all of us, thank you. We really appreciate it for this recognition, and we look forward to this spring when in the article this county's recognized. So thank you.
Great. Okay, thank you for doing us proud. We're moving on to yet another proclamation. This is to name this month as Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and I know we have some folks with our distinguished DA and others, and Supervisor Teixeira will be reading the proclamation.
Thank you, Chairman Hill. Whereas a person's home should be a place of warmth, tranquility, and security, and for most of us, home and family can indeed be counted among our greatest blessings. Whereas the problems of domestic violence are not confined to any particular groups of people but cut across all economic, racial, and societal lines and are supported by societal indifferences, and whereas domestic violence continues to be a major national public health problem affecting nearly 4 million victims each year among U.S. women ages 18 and older, with an estimated 3.3 million or more children witnessing domestic violence in their homes each year, and whereas approximately a quarter of all crime victims served by the San Luis County District Attorney's Office Victims Witness Center are victims of domestic violence, and whereas we must join together in our commitment to addressing the behaviors and causes of this crime so that each and every home can be a safe place of peace and safety, now therefore be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors designates October 2011 as the San Luis Obispo County Domestic Violence Awareness Month.
Okay, we'll turn it over to our DA, Mr. Jerry Shea.
Good afternoon, Jerry Shea, District Attorney. Thank you very much for this opportunity to receive this proclamation declaring this month to be Domestic Violence Awareness Month in the County of San Luis Obispo. It's a fairly significant problem, as we all know. I think, Supervisor Teixeira, you mentioned the fact that there are 25% of the cases that are handled by our Victim Witness Division are domestic violence related. So it's a very significant issue in our county. And that's why we have the Domestic Violence Task Force, also mentioned in the resolution. The Domestic Violence Task Force has been going on for over 16 years in this county, and it has a number of purposes, one of which is to provide training for first responders and law enforcement in the county, to also support any kind of education and prevention efforts that the county has with regard to domestic violence. But one of the other major reasons that the Domestic Violence Task Force exists is to support the women's shelters in this county. We have the Women's Shelter Program of San Luis Obispo County, of San Luis Obispo, and we also have the North County Women's Shelter as well. And as I think you noted, Supervisor Teixeira, there were 7,300 nights of domestic violence housing for domestic violence victims last year by those two shelters. It's a remarkable effort by both of those shelters and one that we need to recognize constantly. So if I may, I'd like to introduce Beth Robb, who is the director of the volunteer and outreach services for the Women's Shelter Program of San Luis Obispo, and Jenny Adams, who's the executive director for the North County Women's Shelter, to say a few words. So, Beth, if you would.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Jerry. Thank you. My name is Beth Robb. I'm with the Women's Shelter Program of San Luis Obispo. And one of the things we have done for October is through Domestic Violence Task Force efforts is we put together a conference for education on October 13th, so it just recently happened, and it was called Ask, Listen, Act. And I'm going to have Paige here give you the toolkits that were passed out at that conference. The goals of the conference were to really educate agencies in our county who are dealing with people who come in through their doors, medical, CAPSLO, wherever they are, who may be dealing with violence in the home. So it was really around intimate partner violence and child abuse, and it was helping them to know how to ask those hard questions. And then, when you've asked the hard question, what do you do with the answer? And giving them the resources and the skills to really deal with a really tough subject that can be very heavy. So we had about 122 in attendance. This is the first kind of big conference we did around this, so we were very excited at the turnout, and we've gotten a lot of good feedback on just the different subjects we had there. We had a good panel of not only survivors, but batterers in recovery. So that was pretty exciting to hear both sides and hear their story. So, but I did want to thank you for all your support year-round that you all give us. Throughout the year with fundraisers and just different education support. And I'll let Jenny say something.
Thank you, Beth.
There you go.
Hi, Jenny Adams, Executive Director of the North County Women's Shelter and Resource Center. There are so many benefits to living in our county. One of my favorites is the true partnership that is shared by the agencies that serve domestic violence victims. The Victim Witness Assistance Center, the Women's Shelter Program of San Luis Obispo, and the North County Women's Shelter and Resource Center together serve several thousands of women, men, and children each year. From the boards of directors to the staff and volunteers, we provide support, information, resources, shelter, and counseling to those affected by intimate partner violence. We have representatives from all three agencies here today. I'd like to ask them to stand and be honored for the good work that they do. So all the people. Again, thank you very much for your ongoing support in helping to eradicate domestic violence here in our county. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Shea, final...
Thank you very much for this proclamation. It means a lot to us, and your support of this particular effort means a lot to us as well. So thank you again for today's recognition. Appreciate it.
Supervisor Meacham?
I just wanted to comment on the wonderful event that was held this last weekend at McPhee's. The dinner was absolutely packed. Great dinner to support the North County Women's Shelter, and I enjoyed that very much.
Yeah, and I see some among the people who helped make the shelter work, some familiar prominent faces, so I want to salute you as well for all the good work you do on behalf of women in our community. Thank you.
Thank you again.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
All right, and we have one more. John, are you here to accept this one? If you would come to one of the lecterns, please. This is recognizing, proclaiming October Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, or Transgender History Month. Let me see if I lost. Oh, here it is. Whereas the state of California legislature and governor have recognized the importance of teaching LGBT history in California public schools, and whereas in 1995 the National Education Association indicated support for LGBT History Month as well as other history months by resolution at its General Assembly, and whereas LGBT History Month is intended to encourage honesty and openness about being lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender, thereby educating others about LGBT people, and whereas LGBT men and women have played and continue to play a critical economic, cultural, and social role in every sphere of life of our country, state, and nation, even though they are often forced to hide their sexual orientation or gender identity. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors, County of San Luis Obispo, State of California, does hereby proclaim October as LGBT History Month in San Luis Obispo County. John, do you want to come up and get this, and we'll say a few things?
I'd just like to say a few words. I'm not a member of the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Board, but overall our goal is to build community and contribute to the local community. As you may or may not know, many, I'll just use the acronym, LGBT individuals are estranged from their families. They've moved from their home of origin. And our organization feels it's very important for us to sponsor events that bring them together so that they can develop their families of choice and the local community. And sometimes the individuals are pretty invisible. I've only been here for 7 years, and the Central Coast is very different from where I used to live, so I know that the community is pretty invisible here compared to where I was. But I'd just like to say one word about a new program. Our newest program has to do with senior advocacy. This is something that's being dealt with across the country because as the general population ages, the number of LGBT people age. And particularly the people who are of World War II age that are LGBT, remember the times when a woman who identified as a man would be walking down the street wearing pants and she could be arrested. It was called the masking law, and it was a law in New York City. There was also the time when they could break into your home if you were having a dinner party and you were suspected of being gay. So those people who are my age and older are starting to experience things like nursing homes and social service providers. And many of them have fears about how they're going to be treated if people know that they're a gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual. So we through a lot of research and collaboration with the AAA here in San Luis, the AAA in Boulder, Colorado, an organization called SAGE in New York, the LA Gay and Lesbian Center, Project Open House in San Francisco. We've developed a program of education to work with people who are service providers to give them a little bit of background about what the concerns and issues are for this group of people. We recently trained the Department of Social Services Adult Abuse Unit. Did a 90-minute workshop for them. We're scheduled to do a workshop for the Adult Services Policy Council next month. And we did one other small one, and we hope to schedule more and more. And if it wasn't for our AAA putting us in touch with the heads of all the service organizations, it would have been very difficult for us to develop these collaborations. So on behalf of particularly on behalf of all the seniors in the community, I thank you for this award.
Thank you, John. Okay. Moving on to our afternoon hearings as we get into place. Madam Clerk, could you introduce the first item, please.
Item C2, a hearing to consider an appeal by the San Luis Coastal Unified School District of the decision of the planning director that a parcel map is required to be processed per the Real Property Division Ordinance Section 21.02.010A9 to subdivide the Avila Schoolhouse property located at 190 San Antonio Street, 3rd District.
Thank you. Mr. Jansen, I see in place.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon to you. Matt Jansen, Department of Planning and Building. Before I hand it over to Ryan, I just wanted to remind you and the audience that today we're here to decide the appeal of a planning director's determination. We are not deciding on whether a project is approved or not. It's just a processing question. Just want to remind everybody of that. Okay, with that, I'll go ahead and hand it over to Ryan.
Thank you. Good afternoon, members of the board. Ryan Hostetter, County Planning Staff. I'm going to start with talk about the site and its location and give you some information on the request by the school district, and then we'll go through briefly what the appeal issues are and then finish with the staff recommendation. So the property in question is located in the community of Avila Beach. It's within the residential multifamily land use category up on the hill. See, this is an aerial photo of the property. It's on the corner of San Antonio and San Luis Streets, and it's our site outlined in yellow here on this aerial photo. And this building is the existing schoolhouse, which is the only structure on the property today. Now, this appeal before you is based on a request by the San Luis Coastal School District, and their request is they would like our department to process a public lot, which is essentially an exemption from having to process a parcel map in order to subdivide the property. In this case, the planning director determined that a map would be necessary, and we'll go into some details on that. And based on that determination by the planning director, the school district is appealing that decision before your board. The language for the map exemption includes land that's conveyed to or from a governmental agency unless the planning director determines that based on substantial evidence that public policy would necessitate a parcel map. And in this case, the planning director determined that there is evidence for the record suggesting that a map should be processed in this case, and it's really based upon the history of the site, which I'm going to go into, and the outcome of a previously approved project that your Board of Supervisors approved in 2009. Now I'll go back to the aerial photo of the site. Right now, we're looking at two underlying lots, and one of those, also known as the north lot, is the lot that contains the schoolhouse. And then this south lot, which was the former play yard for the schoolhouse, contains the approved development that was, again, approved by our board in 2009. And this development, I'll go through a couple elevations, looks like this. Was a multifamily project with 9 units, one of those being an affordable unit. 5 of those were allowed to be vacation rentals. This is the other side. This is actually the view from San Antonio Street. Protection of the schoolhouse is really a result of a long process on that project. Staff had originally brought forth a project that would have demolished the schoolhouse, and based on a public controversy, the developers and planning staff decided to go back and revise the project, and the revised project is what we just saw that was approved, which allowed the schoolhouse to remain, and it remained on that north lot, and while we were processing the project, we were just evaluating the south lot. So the environmental document that was prepared was really focused solely on that development that was approved on the south lot. A part of that environmental determination also included a historic evaluation that the county had prepared, and there was language in that historic evaluation which evaluated a multitude of development scenarios that could potentially happen on these lots. And one of those scenarios included building in front of the schoolhouse, and our architectural historian determined at that time that building in front of the schoolhouse and blocking the view would be a significant impact on the historic resource. And the reason why we bring that up is this is potentially what the public lot would look like. This might not be exact, and we can get clarification from the applicant, but in our discussions previously with them, we were looking at a potential small lot around the schoolhouse, and then which would remain the rest of this piece would be the other lot. So you would have, for example, this parcel one and then parcel two with the schoolhouse. Now, with this layout, really the only place for development to be located would be on this flat portion right in front of the schoolhouse. There's really nowhere else to build unless it included an addition or something onto the schoolhouse, keeping the view of the schoolhouse open, but that wouldn't necessarily necessitate a parcel map configured in this way. I'm going to go through a couple views. This is from San Luis Street. This is that flat area I was mentioning in the schoolhouse, and the lot line is directly behind it. Another view from San Luis Street. So I'm going to go through the appeal issues briefly that the applicant submitted in their letter. And these are summarized here, but basically the school district believes that because the language allows for a government agency to deed off property, essentially, they're a public entity, so we should be able to process this. However, because of the additional language in that exemption that states the planning director has the opportunity to determine that because of public policy, a parcel map could be processed, and that is what we were going off of in this case because of the history and the potential lot configuration, which would force development directly in front of the schoolhouse. So we decided that, or the planning director determined that processing a map would be appropriate in this case. The other second issue in the school district's letter is the need for funding to support school district resources. And while I'm not going to go into this, I'm going to let the school district discuss this issue. This was actually one of the findings from the originally approved project included because of the additional vacation rentals that were approved in their original development scenario, that was providing the income that they were going to need to do this project. So I'm going to let them elaborate on that. But that's what we were anticipating with the original development. And the third appeal issue is the district doesn't agree that necessarily this public lot would have in itself have an environmental impact. And really, it wouldn't directly, but the lot configuration would essentially force any development directly in front of the schoolhouse, and that in and of itself would be an impact on the historic resource. So that is why the planning director determined that really this should be vetted through the map process, and this exemption shouldn't be allowed, and we should be able to evaluate all of that within the map process and determine if that configuration is even appropriate. So with that, staff would recommend that your board adopt and instruct the chairman to assign the resolution denying the appeal and uphold the decision of the planning director which would require the subdivision of the schoolhouse lot going through a parcel map process. We're available for questions.
Thank you, Ryan. I'm going to get some questions from my colleagues here. Supervisor Gibson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions on the public lot process. Does the establishment of a public lot necessitate a change in the land use category from RMF to public facilities?
No, it does not. It is strictly a subdivision of land. It does not change zoning.
And the intent of having a public lot exemption, I don't know, maybe you or council could speak to why do we have the public lot? If we're not talking about a public facility, which this mm-hmm. doesn't seem to be at this point, what's the idea behind creating a public lot?
I'm Tim McNulty with the County Council's office. The public lot provision that's in the county ordinance mirrors the State Subdivision Map Act. The legislature created a number of exemptions for public entities, and I think, you know, perhaps primarily you're thinking about right-of-way acquisitions, but it goes beyond that, obviously. And over the years, the county has approved public lot applications from various public entities when the planning director determined that a parcel map wasn't necessary. So we've done it a number of different times. One that comes to mind for me is, I believe, up in your district, Supervisor Gibson, there was a property near the county line that maybe Mrs. Williams owned or something like that. I think Mr. Green was involved in that proceeding as well, and we approved a public lot there to allow the Forest Service to acquire a parcel.
But typically, it's used to carve off pieces of land that are needed for public facilities, infrastructure, or rights of way. Right?
I think that's right. I mean, I think it is probably somewhat unusual to have a public entity involved in a process that isn't something that's ultimately going to result in a publicly used resource.
Okay. And my other question, maybe not directly germane right now, but I'd be interested at a point in the conversation to know what the planning area standards for this particular parcel are at this point. And I know it might take some time to get there, so I'll yield the floor at this point.
Okay. Mr. Patterson?
Yes. Thank you. Getting that clarification on what typically a public lot is used for, Ms. Hostetter, the zoning on this particular piece of ground would dictate what potential buildings could occur on the property. Is that right? You mentioned
yes.
The underlying zoning does not change?
No.
And what is that on this side? It's multifamily on the back half. Is it the same on the
yes.
front half?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Other questions before we go to the appellant? Mr. Green, are you speaking on behalf of the...
Yes.
Okay. We'll give you 10 minutes to make your presentation and a five-minute rebuttal after public comment.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'm Ty Green here representing San Luis Coastal Unified School District. And there may be a misconception as to what's going on here. I mean, what we were trying to do is we're dealing with a schoolhouse out there that's been deemed to be historic. It's going to have to be taken care of or it'll fall down by benign neglect. The purpose of this application was to protect that historic schoolhouse by allowing it to be put on a separate parcel, and then that parcel transferred to someone else under, well, it'd be a long-term lease, but transferred to someone else. It gets it away. The district isn't going to be maintaining the schoolhouse. It's not going to take funds from education to put into a historic schoolhouse or anything like that. So the idea would be to put this schoolhouse on a separate parcel, and then that parcel would be transferred to someone else who would be responsible for taking care of the schoolhouse and rehabbing it. The district at the same time would maintain the northern part of the property, and I have to disagree with the characterization of the staff as to what's allowed and what isn't allowed on the northern part of that property. What I believe I heard was that based on the prior approval of the existing project, that there can't be anything on the northern part of the project, that it's already been deemed to be an environmental impact, and it's not, and so there's not going to be anything down there. That I don't believe that's true. What I believe is that if there is anything down there and there are impacts on the historic impacts on the school district, on the schoolhouse, that those impacts have to be mitigated to a level of insignificance. That would fall onto the applicant for that project, and I do want to tell you that there will be an application coming down the road for that that property. I don't want to, you know, be look like we're playing hide the ball or anything. I mean, this is a two-step process. One is get the school, the historic schoolhouse transferred to someone that will take care of it. Two is to come back in with an application for the remainder of the property. And with that application, you'll have full environmental review. This will be going through the same process we would go through. What we need, I think there's a question of why are you doing this instead of going through the parcel map process. Well, the parcel map process is going to, first of all, we don't know what's going to happen with the northern part of the property. Second of all, the parcel map process will take, I would think, with the appeal and things, would take 2 or 3 years. In the meantime, the schoolhouse just sits there. And this is something that if we get this approved and get a government lot, the reason we're looking at a public lot is because we can do it immediately, get the property off to somebody, lease it to somebody on a long-term ground lease, and have it the property be taken care of. I think the standard, too, also that needs to be kept in mind is that there needs to be substantial evidence that this is kind of a reversal of every time I'm out here arguing. This time the county has to have substantial evidence to make a determination that the parcel map isn't appropriate. And in this case, I don't know that there's any evidence at all. We're creating a line in the ground to take the schoolhouse and move it to someone else. The actual physical impacts of any development are for a later date. And this isn't one of those piecemeal type things. It's just the next, we're not proposing any development on the north parcel, and so there's no reason that those will all be let for another day. So there's nothing here that's we're trying to sneak through or do anything. We're trying to get the schoolhouse into someone else's hands. We do, I think there was a question about the school district's finances. The district does have, this is surplus property, and the district is trying to use this property to generate income to operate the school district. And that's why that's the reason we're doing the project in the first place. So we will be looking to try to maximize that on the northern part of it, but we fully understand that there are environmental constraints that we have to deal with. And so I don't think this, whatever happens today doesn't have anything to do with eliminating those environmental constraints. We're going to have to deal with the significance issue at that time. So I don't believe I believe Marshall Ohilski is here also to speak for the applicant, who is not the applicant but the developer, and who will be taking the schoolhouse. So I wanted to leave him some time later, but I'm willing to answer any questions if anybody has any.
Okay, we can. We can take some questions now. Are you concluded with your presentation?
I'm sorry.
And then we'll call up Mr. Ohilski as well. But questions for Mr. Green, please, Supervisor Gifton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If the only concern of the district is to get the schoolhouse into the hands of someone to take care of it, you spoke of a long-term ground lease. Why not simply sign a 99-year lease on the facility as it is, independent of where the property line is?
That's what we're trying to get this under point. I don't believe that we can do that for this type of project. This isn't necessarily a commercial use. If we sign a 99-year lease, I believe we still have an issue with the Subdivision Map Act.
Well, okay, two separate questions. You have a schoolhouse that's in need of caretaking. We have other examples like the Port San Luis Lighthouse, a number of other historic structures like the Octagon Barn, where nonprofit groups, conservation-minded, have taken long-term leases on the structure itself, independent of any other activities on the property. Why wouldn't that system work here, independent of any change in any property line that's out there right now?
I don't know. We haven't looked at it from that way, because ultimately this is going to end up being a three-step process. But I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I believe you would have a Subdivision Map Act issue, though, if you tried to do that. Do a 99-year lease.
Okay, you're the landlord.
Yeah, well, I'm telling you, I think it would be a problem. It may be a financing problem for whoever gets the property also on the lease. And you said our only interest was in protecting the schoolhouse. That's not our only interest. We have a second interest, and that is in pursuing a development on the northern part of the property. So it's a two-step process here, not just limited to one.
I understand, and I don't know if council wants to weigh in now or later, but maybe why don't we just hold off on that question and let others get their questions in at this point.
Okay. Mr. Patterson?
Yes, just a quick question. Mr. Green, has the school district reached out to any nonprofit or potential organizations to take this property on?
There have been discussions way back, and the costs for somebody other than a private developer were they're really high. I believe there was a look at to move the school. One time there was a look to move the schoolhouse. There have been discussions, I think, with some of the community groups out there. But there's going to be significant dollars involved in this, in rehabbing the schoolhouse and protecting it. And so I don't know that. I think they've talked to people, and everybody says it's too much money.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Green, and I don't know if this is best for you or for Mr. Ohilski, but last time I met with your clients, of which Mr. Ohilski's partner, they had planned to rehab the schoolhouse and reuse it.
Correct.
And so that's no longer, that's been scrapped, I guess.
No, that's part of this process, is we transfer the property, the schoolhouse to them, and I believe they have plans to rehab the schoolhouse and use, and it'll be put to use. It'll be leased from the district.
Okay.
Groundly, but they do have plans to do. So as part of the preservation, they're going to develop, and I'll let them be specific on what their plans are, but as part of the process, that's what they're intending to do.
So then what's the need for this lot split at this point then, for the public lot that you're asking for?
So we can pursue the development on the remainder of the property to get this property, the schoolhouse, separated from this remainder of the property, and then pursue development on the remainder of the property.
Okay. All right. Would we have time to allow Mr. Ohilski to come up to finish your?
He's got 3 minutes too, anyway. So.
Okay. Well, we'll give him. We stopped the clock for you, so you'd have an appropriate time. So if he wants to,
just know I'm going to talk too long.
That's what we figured, Marshall. We'll just give you half. 5 and a half here.
Hi, Marshall Ohilski. I'm representing the LLC that has a development on the northern. The southern portion of this property. There's a problem here, a basic communication problem, so I'm going to try to get through that if I can. And I've been up here a number of times, and I'm going to get really emotionally involved in this because I'm really frustrated that this, what seems to be really, really simple, has become really, really complicated. You have a parcel here that has a schoolhouse and the remainder of it's vacant. My client has a long-term lease on the southern portion that's adjacent to this. The school district has no funds to preserve the schoolhouse or protect the schoolhouse. Okay? The cost estimate to protect the schoolhouse, not to restore it, just to protect it, is $1 million. We have discussed that with a number of people, and nobody has the funds available to do that. Okay? So my client, in order to generate income for the school district and to protect the schoolhouse, has proposed to lease the schoolhouse on a separate parcel. That's the whole purpose. The restoration and adaptive reuse moves forward on that parcel. The school district then retains the remainder of the land to try to maximize some return at a future date. And there will be a subsequent application. We're not disputing that. But to tie the two together is problematic because the schoolhouse doesn't get protected in the short term. There's no adaptive reuse that can occur because it's on the bigger parcel. We've already been told that any future development on that on the vacant portion of that property will be appealed to the Coastal Commission. You're now looking at a 3 to 5 year process. So the schoolhouse sits there vacant. Assuming if that project got denied, the schoolhouse would sit there for a longer period of time. The whole purpose of this is simple. Put the schoolhouse on its own parcel, let that parcel be leased to my client. They will then go ahead and apply for the adaptive reuse and restoration of the schoolhouse, generating revenue to the school district. If the school district leases the whole property to my client, somebody's going to get hurt because either the school district's going to take less return if my client gets future development, or my client's going to get hurt if they pay more and they don't get future development. So the logical way to do this is to put out the schoolhouse by itself and then lease that to my client and then come back later with a future development proposal. And to answer Mr. Gibson's question, and I believe that I'm correct, and Mr. McNulty, I know, will correct me if I'm wrong, we believe because it's a public lot now and it's a public facility that they cannot do a long-term lease on the building, that they have to do it with the ground. We don't think they can do a building lease. We believe it has to be a ground lease. And if County Council wants to disagree with me on that, but it's held by a public entity, and our research shows that it has to be a ground lease. It cannot be a long-term building lease. And the acknowledgement here is that the purpose is to restore the schoolhouse, to get the schoolhouse to be a productive member of the community, for lack of a better term, come back later with an application on the remainder of the property. That application will be subject to full review. There's no question about that. There's no preconceived notions here. We have a difference of opinion with staff as to what the EIR says and what the requirements are, because it does say there could be an impact on the property, on the schoolhouse if a development occurs on the front of the property. But it also says it could be mitigated to less than significant levels. That's something that has to occur during that review process of that permit. But there's no application. It's really, really frustrating to me because there is no development proposed with this application. It's just put the schoolhouse on its own property so the school district can be done with it and my client can take it. That's the sole purpose right now. And just, I'm going to have to throw out a legal argument here where I would disagree with staff, and I've discussed this with staff. You know, the burden of proof not to process a public map falls on the county. And it says, in the language of both the MAP Act and the county ordinance, says that they can deny this based on substantial evidence. And I have not seen any evidence, much less any substantial evidence, that there is an impact from this map that's negative. It's a positive impact. It allows the schoolhouse to move forward and be restored. And I'm sorry I got so emotional, but this just to me doesn't make logical sense, and I have a problem when I can't get my teeth into something like that. So, and I'll be happy to answer questions, and Mr. Belcher is here who represents also the developer.
Okay. So just to be clear, Mr. Ohilski, what you're saying is that the project that would restore and reuse the schoolhouse could not go forward without this separate lot because
not in the short term, correct?
Because
for two reasons. One is that they would come that first of all we can't work out the terms of a lease with the district because, like I said, it's going to be weighted one way or the other. Either my client's going to pay less because of the undeveloped portion of the property, or my client's going to pay more based on the development potential of that property. And what we want to do is base it on solid facts and figures as to what there is today. The second problem is, and I don't want to diminish this, but we've been told that if there's any future development proposed on that property, it's going to be appealed to the Coastal Commission. And the time frame involved there is horrific. Everybody knows that. And if we want to get this restored and used in the short term, that's the rationale. Put the schoolhouse on its own lot, and the other process project will go through the process. But let's protect the schoolhouse. Let's get this thing moving forward. I don't see the downside to this, quite frankly.
Okay. Let's, before we go to the public, would staff like to, while things are, and that could include Mr. McNulty and Ms. Husted or anyone else, want to respond to some of the assertions from the appellant?
I have a couple things. Quickly, Mr. Green brought up benign neglect, and we actually discussed that in our hearings for the original project, and that's why there was a condition of approval placed on the original development, which required arresting any decay on the schoolhouse with the original development. So I just wanted to point that out, that condition of approval stands today.
Meaning that they're responsible
for arresting from the decay.
Approval that we did last year or a year and a half ago to stabilize the schoolhouse.
It didn't require restoration of the schoolhouse with that project because really that project, the schoolhouse was left on its own lot. Staff and the community understood that that's why this project was laid out that way, so that the schoolhouse could be on its own lot, which it is. And that condition was placed on it at the time to arrest any decay, and then in the future, when the school district decided what type of reuse would go on, we would address the restoration at that point. So that's my only comment. I don't know if anybody else has any.
Ms. Griffin?
Did you want to let Mr. Belcher talk?
We'll let him turn in a slip, maybe, if he wants to work on the rebuttal at 5 minutes after staff, but you can also speak in public comment. We'll let you turn in the slip then, John.
I would, but my notes are on the back of the book.
I'm sure you can get another slip over there, right to your left. Ms. Griffin?
I did want to just point out before County Council speaks, I'm glad that Ryan pointed out the condition that's a part of the development that was approved on the back half of the lot. If that's the way you want to describe it, it's kind of a hard lot to describe, but... The other item that I wanted to point out is that given our discussions with the school district and how they would configure the public lot, we have a concern that there isn't an opportunity for reuse of the schoolhouse because there's not land associated with it that would allow for parking and, you know, yard space or items that we would typically see with reuse. So we were concerned that the actual parcel configuration would limit how the schoolhouse could be reused because it didn't appear to have a whole lot of land around it, at least from the discussions that we had with the school district about the configuration of the parcel.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'm Tim McNulty with the County Council's office. I just wanted to say that if Mr. Ohilski is correct that because of the ownership of the school that it needs to be leased as an entire parcel and not just the building, but rather the building along with the parcel that it sits on, if he's correct about that, there really isn't any reason why that couldn't happen while the school district and or its developer partner goes through the entitlement process and we determine what entitlements exist there. There really isn't anything that would preclude both of those things happening at the same time, other than perhaps what he asserts is the, a market reason why no potential lessee of the school site would take it unless they got the something less than the entire parcel, which I wasn't quite clear about.
Okay. Mr. Gibson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Quick question to staff, just to refresh my memory, please, on the initial proposal that created the development on the south side. Was that both a parcel split and a development plan for those units, or were there two lots to start with?
It started with two, and then the rear lot was subdivided into multiple multifamily lots with nine units. I think it ended up with four or five lots
within
within that one, yes.
Okay, and do we know what the ownership of that back lot or that subdivided into nine units is? Who owns that right now?
I believe the developers have a lease over that piece from the school district for 99 years to do that project.
Okay, so the developers are leasing from the public entity the parcel that includes entitlements to do multifamily housing. Thank you.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes, thank you. Ms. Hostetter, could you put the parcel map up again? Because there's conversation about what's being proposed to split on that northern parcel. The configuration, why is it not recommended that that northern parcel just be split in half rather than just circling the building, if you will? I share Ms. Griffin's concerns that how functional is it for reuse if there's no land that accompanies the building itself?
Sure. And this, I'm sure the school district and their developers can work on a different configuration, but this is what was originally discussed from the applicant. But I'm sure that, you know, a line all the way across where my cursor is could be suggested. However, the issue with parking or reuse of the building remains because even if you'd split this in half where my cursor is, this is really not usable. There's no space for parking. This is incredibly steep here in the back. It is a narrow, steep area. Really, the only flat, developable portion with access remains on this piece right here. So I think originally we were thinking about parking or something in this location to support the schoolhouse. So that's what was discussed.
Well, and there's also access to buildings on the southern lot, or actually, if I read the maps correctly, are from the back side of the schoolhouse. Is that correct?
Yes.
Right in there?
There is access here. Mm-hmm. And I think they could also take access on the north lot as well. So there's multiple points.
Okay. But this is what you've illustrated here is what's been discussed by the developer to date.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. One more question before we go to the public, and this is for Mr. McNulty. The contention based both Mr. Green and Mr. Ohilski was is that substantial evidence does not exist on the part of the county to deny this this request. Your reading of that?
I think that their statement of the law is correct in both instances, that in order to require a parcel map here of the school district, the board will have to find that substantial evidence exists. The substantial evidence, however, is just evidence that public policy necessitates a parcel map. That's the test. Is there substantial evidence that public policy necessitates a parcel map? I try not to be the one that decides whether substantial evidence exists. I think my role is really to describe what the test is. You need to look at what's been presented by your staff and by the school district and the developer and members of the public and determine whether or not you can find substantial evidence to support the idea that public policy really requires a map here.
Thank you. Okay, we will go to the public. I have requests to speak, and if you would like to speak, please get them in, and then we'll have a 5-minute rebuttal from a closing statements from the appellant as well. We'll start with Christopher Hellenius, followed by Pete Kelly.
Chair, members of the board, good afternoon. I'm Christopher Hellenius. My family has had property in Avila Beach for about 62 years. We reside there currently, and I'm here in that capacity. I think that your planning department has handled this matter thoroughly and made appropriate recommendations. There's no question left on the table about whether the schoolhouse is an historic building. And I believe that the applicant should process a map on this parcel, because there needs to be an opportunity to evaluate whether the proposed development would negatively impact that historic building. It's the last historic building in Avila Beach. I mean, the Unical cleanup has basically caused the removal of all the other historic buildings that would otherwise potentially have fit within that framework. I'm thinking particularly, for example, of the Custom House. That was an old building that's now gone, lost to history. So I think that, you know, you have a professional staff. They've carefully evaluated the situation. It seems to me that it would be inappropriate to create two parcels out of the northern parcel at this point in time. When you have a parcel map, you can look at the whole unit. You don't run into any potential problems that would arise from a development being proposed on the non-school portion of the northern lot, and you lost authority over what impact that would have. My concern is that you might lose authority over the impact that it would have with respect to the school lot, because now there'd be two separate lots. I think that everybody in the room and everybody in Avila Beach is supportive of the school district's efforts to try and raise funds and meet its burdens in a creative fashion, and I think the people within the community have been supportive of the developers in their approach, generally speaking, but I do think there's strong feelings within the community that this should be processed as a map and not exempted through the public lot process. So, excuse me. So those are my thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lanis. Mr. Kelly, followed by Ann Brown. Mr. Belcher, are you going to speak in the rebuttal period, or do you want to?
I guess I'll speak in the rebuttal period.
There we go. Mr. Kelly?
Hi, I'm Pete Kelly. I'm president of the Avila Community Service District, but I'm just speaking as a private citizen and member of the Save Our Schools Committee. I'm just as confused here as the other party says they were. No one has ever approached us about purchasing the school property in the schoolhouse. I've met with Mr. Hodge I don't know how many times in different committees. The Save Our School Committee has never been approached by anybody. Our founding member, who died 2 weeks ago, would have given his fortune, considerable, to the restoration of the schoolhouse as a museum. But Now his property will eventually go to the Wild Cherry Canyon Nature Conservancy and the Heart Association in Washington, D.C. When the school district first started this process, they came to the Avila Civic Association and said they wanted to create housing for potential teachers that were going to move into the district, kind of subsidized housing. That was the open salvo. I think that the planning is done very good with this, and that I don't support the appeal. And there's some interesting things in these letters between the school district and the county. And this is in referring to the county, the school district saying that the county required, it says, however, the county did not require that the structure be classified historic. And in fact, the project developer chose to treat the structure as historic in an effort to avoid the extra time and costs associated with preparing environment impact report to further study the potential historic characteristics of the building and impacts of demolishing or substantiated. So the developers agreed that it was historic, and they thought that would save them money. Very good. Okay. And then as far as the school district talking about unfunded mandates and that the county's required, I mean, is requiring them to do an unfunded mandate. Okay, we request the Board of Supervisors overturn the director's determination in the light of this being an unfunded mandate. Listen, Avila gave San Luis Coastal this property and this schoolhouse, it goes back to the 1870s in Avila, okay? A superintendent of schools of San Luis Coastal in the 1980s, Irv Nicolai, changed the zoning because he anticipated something like this in the future. Aren't school districts supposed to support school buildings? They've never used the Avila Schoolhouse since they took it over, except for special ed was in there for a while and the church was in there for a while. They haven't maintained this property at all. And then there's the question of who do you go to maintain the property? The school district says talk to Mr. Hodge. Now the school district's saying, well, it doesn't belong to Mr. Hodge. It's not leased by Mr. Hodge. That's why we want to get a separate parcel. So this whole thing that I'm hearing isn't reflecting reality. Now, what we've said all along is work with the Avila community and we could have an Avila museum and a history lab for San Luis Coastal. How does it help children in education by building condominiums in front of the historic schoolhouse? That's number one.
Mr. Kelly, can I ask you to sum up, please?
Yeah, I will sum up. That's it. That's all right. If I could rebuttal later, maybe that'd be okay because we don't have a staff of attorneys here to respond.
There is
one thing, though. This whole thing about appealing to the Coastal Commission, we called the planning department in a meeting at Ann's house yesterday and said, can we appeal to the Coastal Commission? And they said no. So this thing Ospinski's bringing up of the spectrum of the Coastal Commission, we didn't even know that was true. But it is good information. Thank you.
Ms. Brown?
Good afternoon. My name is Ann Brown. Excuse me. And I'm addressing you as a chair of Avila Valley Advisory Council, which has been continually supportive of the schoolhouse and the residents of Avila. As a matter of fact, I live on San Antonio Street, and I pass the site of the schoolhouse every day. You're in receipt of a letter over my signature from AVAC supporting your planning director and staff in their denial of the school district request for a lot split. In addition, the Avila Beach Civic Association expresses its support also. It's important to educate students, but it is also important to provide economic resources to the county, and I think that the use of that schoolhouse would be one of those resources. The schoolhouse could be such a resource for tourists, residents, and students as an educational tool for their studies of California and county history. I heard when the Friends of the Library were here today, that the use of volunteers in several libraries throughout the county. This could be another site for a volunteer library. In the original proposal for this property, it was stated that development would provide moderate housing stock for teachers and firemen whose salaries limited their housing choices. Whatever happened to that idea? The district talks about children who benefit, but one wonders. I urge you to deny the appeal before you today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. And that's the only request I have from the public, so I will close it to the public and bring it back to the appellant's closing statement, 5 minutes. I see Mr. Belcher coming forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I'll try to keep it under that time limit. just to respond to a couple technical things, Mr. Patterson, Supervisor Patterson, asked about the lines on the map, and I think staff expressed some concern they didn't really know exactly where the lines were. But the line does go straight across. It's not a box. My engineer informs me that the actual application just severs that parcel in two pieces. I think the really important thing is here, I think planning staff and maybe members of the public are kind of second-guessing the efforts of the school district to try to maximize both the reuse of the school site and the site itself. So if the board really wants to help the school district, I think they need to be careful not to sort of second-guess what the strategies are that have been in place for, I think, 6 years at this point. Because I pulled out some an agenda from the November 2nd, 2005 meeting of the Avila Beach Committee, and I think you heard from a couple of members there. And the planning staff at that time, in November 2005, asked the committee to step up with their plan for the schoolhouse and to finance it. And that request has been announced and reiterated many times over the last 6 years. But the members of the community did not do that. They objected to the proposals to relocate the schoolhouse. They did not advance a plan. We offered a plan for reuse, which would have included incorporation of the historic features, and I think we always will. But in this memo, the Ryan indicated to the planning committee members that they needed to find a feasible place to restore the structure, gather the money to restore it, obtain minor use permits, coordinate with the developers, and all this was talked about in 2005, and we spent countless hours and got nowhere, and today we're nowhere. The reason for this public lot is to provide an opportunity for someone to do an adaptive reuse of the schoolhouse. In the world of financing, you need to have a separate parcel in order to get financing. Nobody is going to loan on a property for anything if it's tied up with another structure. You can't build an apartment building in the back of your single-family house. They have to be separated in order to obtain financing. And it's a tremendous cost. And the adaptive reuse of the schoolhouse has been discussed with your planning staff. You'll see it because it has to come back to you in a discretionary permit. You will see a project that could be built next to the schoolhouse because it has to come back to you for a decision. And all the mitigation that's already in place by your board will ensure that the schoolhouse is protected, either from an historic perspective and a visual perspective. It is not the case that you have not made that environmental determination. In your environmental review that you approved the last time you saw this project that went before the subdivision review board before it, it says, this study, this initial study, which is your negative declaration, addresses preliminary plans for future development of Parcel 2. The future develop will likely involve the provision of 4 to 7 dwelling units. That's what your environmental document said. This is not news. You have already endorsed an environmental document that provided for the very mitigation the public is talking about. The mitigation says that when and if a project comes in next to the schoolhouse, the environmental impacts will have to be accounted for in terms of the schoolhouse. There's absolutely nothing that changes with this parcel map. You still can require parking, which can be done through off-site means, which is done all over Avila. You can still require historical commemorative value being in the project. You can still require environmental protection of the visual impacts from anything that goes next to it. You haven't lost one single tool at your discretion. You have all the tools to condition the future project. The one thing you can do today is ruin the financing capability of this proposal. We can't do adaptive reuse, or it will be extremely difficult. It would have to be financed with cash. It could not be financed commercially if you deny this of this public lot. And that's what the school district is asking you to do, because they know that without that step, we lose a financial planning tool that's extremely important to the adaptive reuse of the schoolhouse. I think public policy requires this public lot. This is the fastest, easiest way for us to get the schoolhouse adaptive reuse on track. In fact, that's what we'd like to do next. And we'll be doing it with the committee. They'll be fully involved. Your board will have the final say in whether you like that adaptive reuse. So all we're asking for is the tools to get there.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Belcher. That will close it to the public, and we will bring it back to the board for questions and discussion. Mr. Gibson.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'd like to go back to the question of what planning area standards exist on this parcel right now. Just as it stands, schoolhouse on its separate parcel, what can be done with that parcel at this point, and what controls are there?
So it's zone residential multifamily, and the Avila Beach specific plan discusses very specific height requirements, setbacks, and all of that sort of information in the specific plan. So that's all outlined. So I'm not sure if you're looking for other uses or
what. Well, I guess as I think through this, I can see points on both sides of this discussion. And it's my understanding that the public lot process does not allow for any conditions to be put on that subdivision.
That's correct.
Neither on the so-called public lot created or the remainder that's left over.
That's right. If you want the opportunity to condition the creation of the lot, then you need to have them go through a parcel map.
And so if the public lot process were to go forward, we'd carve off something that held the schoolhouse, and then the remainder parcel, the northernmost piece of that property, would be developable subject to the planning area standards that are in place. And I was curious as to what that meant and how that interacted with potential historic. The applicants make a big deal about mitigating environmental impacts of a project, but the first line of consideration when we talk about land use decisions is how it comports with our coastal zone land use ordinance. And so I'm wondering what the coastal zone land use ordinance says and what tools we would have to consider a discretionary project on a parcel on the northernmost piece of that parcel should a public lot be constructed.
So we would, because of its location, be processing a coastal development permit.
Right.
And with any type of map, if they want to do condos, it would include further subdivision of that piece most likely.
Mm-hmm.
And it would go through the normal, it would be most likely a development plan and tract map process together, which is typical in the community of Avila, and goes through the Planning Commission review process. And there is requirements in the specific plan for density, floor area, height requirements, and design requirements as well.
And have we setbacks and all sorts of other things? Have we determined what the height requirements that would exist on that remainder lot would do in terms of impact to the schoolhouse?
Sure. Well, the height requirements are they vary based on solar access for neighboring properties, but they would be potentially up to 35 feet, 25 feet. It really depends on the project. Most common is 20 to 25 feet.
Okay.
So it depends on the project. There's a sliding scale in the specific plan, and I don't have – let's see. I can pull it up. But I think that it starts at 20 feet, but it can go up to actually 25 feet if they meet criteria and have a certain roof pitch. So we're looking at 25 feet most likely.
Okay. And that's on the one side. If the public lot process is pursued, if we go on the parcel map, all subdivisions are discretionary actions, and the resulting parcels could be subdivided with conditions that would apply to any future development on it that would be different and supersede the planning area standards that exist right now. Am I correct?
A project could be approved with conditions on it. They wouldn't necessarily supersede the planning. The planning area standards would apply, and they would need to comply with those because they are ordinance requirements.
Right, but if we were to go through the parcel map process and create a lot split, let's say we split mm-hmm. that thing in that existing parcel in half, we could condition any future development on the northernmost piece that's left to have lower height limits, for instance, than the planning area standards
yes.
allow.
Yes, and that can be done also as mitigation for visual or yes.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm just looking for the tools that we have. Sort of leave it to you to, as supervisor of the district, to lead us on the discussion after questions.
Mr. Gibson, and I'll have a question for Ryan after you.
Yeah, I had a question for any of our staff members. There was discussion about the public lot process expediting this lot split, basically, as opposed to pursuing a parcel map, and we've heard testimony that it's not appealable to the Coastal Commission, and we've heard testimony that it is, and the parcel map route, and therefore it could take many years to reach a point where the school district could lease the schoolhouse site and then proceed with development on the northern piece. Which of those comments were true relative to the length of time it would take to pursue a parcel map? Is that appealable to the Coastal Commission or not? And then what's the typical timeline if we pursue a parcel map?
Supervisor Patterson, it's a good question. I'll start with the parcel map. If the parcel map meets the criteria, it is appealable to the Coastal Commission as a discretionary land use permit. In this case, I'm not looking at a map, but I can almost guarantee you that it probably is appealable for one reason or another. The public lot process, I'm not as certain about. I know that if I called the Coastal Commission staff, they would have a pretty definite opinion that it would be a subdivision and that it would be appealable to them, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we would agree with that. The public lot process runs fairly quickly compared to a parcel map process in that the planning director makes a determination as to whether a public lot has been created or not, and then that item appears on the subdivision review board's consent agenda, and it's done. Whereas a parcel map goes through the entire review process, the CEQA process, and takes probably 4 to 6 months to process. So the comparison is, I'm going to say, several weeks to several months. Mm-hmm. And if the public lot's not appealable to the Coastal Commission, then that process is quite shorter. If appealable, then it's open-ended.
Okay, and then there was a question that Supervisor Gibson raised, and I wasn't really clear on the outcome of that, and that is the difference in applying area standards. We may not be able to apply those to a parcel map, but could to a publicly created lot, but those could be applied to a parcel map.
I think the short answer is yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Question I have, let me see, Ryan's working with Cammy, but I wanted to get back to Mr. Kelly's remark, Ryan, and I think we talked about this yesterday a bit. The point that he made was about the previous project that we approved, the previous part, that the push for the historic designation allowed for that to move more quickly. Ultimately, is that? Could you clarify that a little bit, just so that we have a better understanding of that?
Sure. During that process, when we took the original project to the Planning Commission, it was determined then because the community had hired an architectural historian on their own to do an evaluation of the schoolhouse. The staff's historian's document from the applicant that was originally submitted stated the schoolhouse was not historic. And that's why we were processing the project originally under the assumption that it wasn't historic and it was actually proposed for demolition. So when we got before the Planning Commission, the community members hired their architectural historian who prepared their own report, and we had conflicting evidence for the record, and we determined we needed to go back. We potentially had a fair argument in the record stating that there's two professionals, one side stating it's not historic, one stating it's historic, so we could get into having to do an EIR. And so we went back, and the applicant, working with the applicants, decided, well, let's treat it as historic, and we'll assume it's historic based on all that information in the record, and process the project in that manner. And so that's why the development was approved with the schoolhouse on its own north lot and then the development on the south lot.
Without a full EIR?
Yes, right.
Okay. And what have they done to meet the approval, the condition of approval on the previous, on the other lot where the nine units are going to arrest the decay of the, what do we know that they have done to arrest the decay of the existing schoolhouse?
Sure. We've been working with the developer, and specifically Mike Hodge, the project engineer, and they've hired an alarm company to install an alarm in the schoolhouse. They've had their engineers go out and weatherize portions of the building, and so as far as we know, that those are the types of items that have occurred, including fencing and securing it so trespassers don't enter in the building. And and we've been hearing from members of the community when a gate is open or a door is open, they let us know, and we immediately tell the applicant, and they've been responsive in going out and making sure that it stays buttoned up. So that's what's incurred to date.
Okay. Cammie?
Well, I was able to do some research to answer the other half of the question that Mr. Jansen was trying to answer. In Title 21, in the coastal part of Title 21 that's adopted as part of the local coastal plan, they define, or we define, subdivision as including the public lot process. And subdivision is a part of the definition of development in the coastal zone, and therefore the public lot would actually be appealable to the Coastal Commission.
So either the
either way that's
okay. Mr. Meacham?
Ryan, you just mentioned that they're notified if they see somebody going in there or the door is open or whatever. There's no other requirements at this time from the folks that have possession of this to do anything further. Is that correct?
Just arresting the decay is what was required.
And that's
weatherizing the building.
That's pretty ambiguous. I mean,
to keep it in its current state, no, in not allowing it to further deteriorate until such time a proposal is brought forward to redo the building.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Well, this is more complicated than it seems, but, I find it difficult to, because the public lot process doesn't allow us to condition it, I'm not really sure how we could possibly grant that. It seems that you have a historic building here that everybody has at some point agreed, and experts agreed that it is a historic building. As people in Avila know, it may, in fact, be the only existing historic resource left in the community. The plans have changed a lot from the developers on behalf of the school district, and I understand that, that a lot of this is, I guess, to do with market, though it was always my understanding that it was going to be restored and reused in some commercial purpose, whether it was a bed and breakfast or further condos. So I don't see how that is precluded from going through the parcel map process. I just don't see how it should be exempt from the map process. It seems that if a lot were created now, there is no guarantee that there'll be usable land around the schoolhouse, for one thing, is a problem for me. I mean, if you're to restore it and so forth, and then You have no parking. You have no other property around it. That seems like it's being sort of coved off with this. So I'm not comfortable with that. I'm not comfortable with the fact that we're not able to condition it in this process itself. But and it does seem that in the previous project, it was certainly expedient to agree to the historic designation in order to avoid a full EIR, and that was a project that I think that Mr. Hodge and others did a very good job of working with the community group to come to an agreement, because by the time it came to our board, it seemed that everybody was okay with what was proposed, and that there was a general consensus that this had, that the process had worked well, and that the Mr. Hodge and others had gone out of their way to make sure that the community interests were best represented. So at this point, I would still favor that process, and I don't think that that process precludes future plan that might in fact reuse the schoolhouse and might in fact even allow for further development. But I wouldn't want to see further development that completely impairs the schoolhouse's presence in the community either, which seems eminently possible by a public lot. So that's where I am. I don't know if my colleagues want to pick up Mr. Gibson.
Mr. Chairman, and I'd ask planning staff to correct me if I'm wrong, but we often bring subdivision actions along with development plans or whatever the appropriate permit is, and I would assume this would be a development plan because of the size and complexity of this. We often bring them along in parallel and act under the same hearing, and because the environmental impacts are the same, the general broad scope of issues are the same. I don't see that the subdivision of this is going to necessarily hold up the development options here. For instance, in the previous project, the already approved project, there was basically condo kind of subdivision that went on as part of that, and I do believe I acted on that either at the Planning Commission or the Board, and that seemed to move forward. I'm not persuaded that failure to grant a public lot, in the next few weeks precludes the ability to start consideration of reuse or start consideration of whatever else the school district wants to do. I'm certainly sympathetic to the district wanting to maximize the financial opportunities of a piece of surplus property. That's a reasonable goal. In this instance, though, because they're operating in a dense environment with a lot of significant challenges, namely to do right by the historic structure that is right in the middle of where they want to develop, it's going to be a little more challenging. And I just think that in the classic business of land use regulation, which is the balancing of one sets of rights and interests with other sets of rights and interests, that the parcel map is the right way to go.
And just to follow up on that before we go to Supervisor Patterson, it seems you can't have it both ways, which is to acknowledge the historic importance of it so that the first part of their development would be approved more expediently, and then find that now is an obstacle to it. I think that I have always agreed with the notion that the school district needs to maximize the value of its assets, but that doesn't mean at any cost. And in fact, what was agreed upon here was that this is a historic resource that is important to the community, and therefore there needs to be care taken with that. It doesn't preclude the school district in an agreement with the developers from. I've never agreed that somehow the schoolhouse itself had to be restored and then given back to the community for some other purpose. I've always understood, just as with historic reuse throughout the state, throughout the country, that often this is the way historic buildings are preserved. They are put to you look at our downtown here. That's a good example of historic buildings that are preserved for different purposes. So I don't think that any of that precludes it, and I don't think that potential further development is precluded by this either. So I don't think it's as and I understand Mr. Ohilski's concerns, but I don't think it's as grave as that. And I think if Mr. Hodges able to do what he did before, which I actually was quite impressed with his ability to work with the group to come to some agreement. Maybe some of the fears of what might happen in terms of appeals would, and I'd be happy to work with them as well, would go away. But I think at this point, what's most important is that that we stick with this understanding and looking at the conditions that protect this historic resource without going forward too quickly. Mr. Patterson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Based on what we've heard this afternoon, I'm inclined to believe that the parcel map route is the appropriate way to pursue this, and I am inclined to support staff's recommendation.
Okay. Further comments? Okay. That's essentially what I would say, and I do think that there's an opportunity here through this process for the school district to continue to use this property both for their own purposes of maximizing their asset, but also for helping the community's purpose of restoring and preserving this important historic resource. So I'm going to, with that, I am going to move staff's recommendation to deny the appeal and to uphold the planning director's decision to turn down the exemption from the public lot.
I'll second.
Second by Mr. Patterson. Any further discussion? Madam Clerk, you're going to clarify my motion. I can tell you.
No.
Oh, okay. You're trying to get. That's right. She has a.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
No.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
And Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. We shall move on to
take
a five-minute break? Okay, let's take a five-minute break before we get to our next hearing. Okay, we're back for our final hearing. Be so kind to settle in. We've got staff in place, and I see Mr. Bissell at the controls down here. So are we going to go straight to you, Mr. Bissell?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the board, John Bissell, County Planning Staff. This is the request to waive building permit fees and public facility fees for a single-family residence on the Duval property. Get the PowerPoint working here.
Okay.
Anyway, waiver.
Mr. Russell, I'm sorry. I've already screwed up by not allowing Madam Clerk to introduce the item formally before. So this will give you a chance to make sure the PowerPoint's working well. Yes. Madam Clerk, if you could be so kind to formally introduce our item, our last hearing item.
C3, a hearing to consider the tentative action taken by your board on August 16, 2011 to defer building permit fees and public facility fees for a new single-family dwelling of approximately 8,000 square feet to be constructed by Sunny Acres Incorporated and Dan Duvall, 2nd District.
Okay. Now back to you, Mr. Bissell. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Now that it's all working well.
Okay, so the project description was just remember with by the clerk, the so the board direction on August 16th was to defer the fees for this project, and you directed staff to return with conditions and to defer the payment of the fees, findings and conditions to defer the payment of the fees, and your board also directed staff to get more information on the Sunny Acres nonprofit and its operation. Now, there is more information that we received based on a letter that I wrote. On the last page of your staff report, there was some items, one item missing about the board of directors and the minutes from the meetings. We have not received that information yet. They had said they were going to submit that, but we didn't receive that. So findings for deferral, staff looked at the issue and what the board has done in the past, and so one of the facility fees, one way to defer them or otherwise reduce them or waive them is to show that it doesn't generate the same need for public facilities as another other uses might, similarly, or other residential uses, for example. And because of the situation with this residence and the sober living facility and the people being, you know, living there, working on site, mostly remaining on site most of the time, we felt that you could make this finding that the same need is not generated for public facilities as would be generated by other single-family residences. This may also reduce county costs. That's another finding for the facility fee waiver, in the sense that the individuals you know, live in the community, and it's the project is not funded directly by the county, and it provides a service that might reduce otherwise reduce county costs. And that's also finding three, is that the majority of the clients live and work and receive county services on the property, and therefore they are less likely to use public facilities for which the fees are collected. So those are three possible findings that your board could make. Building permit fees, you can do that based on a public benefit. But and one of the findings, first finding, is that the project does not or project meets a previously identified or recognized need by the Board of Supervisors, because in this instance it will serve people who are previously homeless, so we felt that it did meet a need that has been recognized by the board in the past. This also project also provides a unique sober living environment not currently available, and it will serve individuals that are not always adequately served in the county at this time. The Duval project targets mainly homeless individuals who have substance abuse problems, and which is a harder segment of the population to serve, and so we felt that this would be a potential finding for your board to make. Also that the project has generated some community support, which is evidence in past hearings you've held on this project or on other parts of this project. So in terms of the findings, those are the findings that we felt that would be reasonable for your board to make in this situation. Conditions, we also felt that some conditions should be applied to this project, one being that the use of the residence as a sober living facility needs to be maintained in order to get this fee deferral. That's the essentially the first condition. The other condition is that the owner shall comply with all the orders, court orders affecting the property, and the owner shall resolve all land use, building, and health and safety violations on the property before this fee deferral would take effect. Now, that issue, there's two things going on there. This would be the fee deferral. We're putting the same condition in here that currently is on the property. Basically, he has to resolve the violations anyway to get his building permit issued. We're saying that your board should reinforce that by giving him a fee deferral. You should reinforce the fact that he needs to resolve those violations. Also, number three, another important one, is the owner should maintain the property in a manner that it remains free of land use, building, and health and safety violations. And that's a big one, because the property has tended to drift on that issue quite a bit in the past. The fourth condition is that in the event that the owner does not perform under this obligation, then the fees would become payable. Fifth is that the owner agrees and acknowledges that to sign this covenant and agreement that we have prepared, which is kind of a means to have the owner's signature to ensure that he understands and will comply with these conditions. So with that, we recommend that your board approve the resolution to defer building permit fees and public facility fees based on the findings and conditions in Exhibit A, and authorize the director of planning and building to sign the agreement. And that would conclude my presentation.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Roussel. Any questions for Mr. Roussel before we go to the public? Okay. With that, Mr. Belcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have here speaking on behalf of Dan DeBall and Sunny Acres. I don't have any difficulty with the proposal. I think staff's done a good job of expressing the findings necessary for the action, and the conditions seem appropriate in light of our previous discussions here. I did want to mention a couple things. On October 6th, I submitted another full set of building plans for this particular structure through architect Tom Brakovich to the county. Mr. Bissell informed me that he is that those are in plan check now. So actually, this is moving toward reality, I hope. We understand we still have a lot to work out with the county on zoning violations. You know, since 2005 when we were last given an all clear by the county. And I would mention that there have been some demolition of the structures and portions of structures that have been complained about, bathrooms notably, and so we're hoping that as we continue to work with your planning and building department that they'll be able to reach agreement on how to best comply with your land use ordinances. So with that, I encourage you to finalize the steps that you started your last time you heard this matter. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Belcher. I think I have one question, perhaps, Mr. Patterson. Is it for Mr. Belcher?
Yes, okay. It is, Mr. Chair. Mr. Belcher, in your letter dated October 4th, you mentioned, and this was basically describing the current conditions relative to number of people living on the site and talking about the financing and that sort of thing. You also mentioned that there are seven people on their board, the Sunny Acres nonprofit, that meets annually or more frequently, but at least annually, and that you would provide agendas and minutes of the last 2 to 3 meetings, and you would have that to us within a week. And as Mr. Bissell mentioned, we haven't gotten that yet. And I'm just real curious how it operates, because I've been on the board 7 years, and we've been hearing about Sunny Acre issues. We've had a variety of board members come and go, and I'm just really curious how it's operating, how stable it is. It is an important program, but one of the assurances that we need is that the program is functioning, that it continues and it's doing what it's purported to be doing. And can you provide that information to us, the names of the seven-member board and also the minutes and the agendas from the last 2 or 3 meetings?
Yes. First of all, I don't represent this board in its administrative deliberations, but I am advised by staff members here. I just asked about this, that they do have some 4 pages of minutes in the last meeting, and they have this year's information readily at hand, and I can get that to staff. And Mr. Duvall has been gone for, I think, most of the last month, and so I wasn't able to get that information as quickly as I wanted to. But I do have assurances I can provide that, as to previous years, there are, as I understand it, previous secretaries that are not with the board, and it might be a little tougher. But I definitely have personal knowledge that there are meetings that are taking place, that and there are records of the meetings, and that the board is functioning.
Okay, and you can provide some of that to us?
I can.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Belcher. Okay, that will close it to the public, and I'll bring it back to the board. Mr. Gibson.
Seeing no other comments or questions from my colleagues, and thanking Mr. Belcher for his, I'll move approval.
Second.
Okay. Moved by Supervisor Gibson, second by Supervisor Meacham. If there's no further questions or comments, a roll call from Madam Clerk, please.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Patterson?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes, thank you. Okay, that will do it for today. We will adjourn until next Tuesday. Thank you very much. Oh, I have one. Actually, I hope we didn't get cut off by the radio yet. Somebody left a ring here in our chambers. It's a. It looks like it could be a pearl or a faux pearl with other such. I'm really great at describing jewelry, as you can tell. It's a woman's ring, so let's just say that. If you are missing a woman's ring because you left it here in the Board of Supervisors chambers, I'm going to leave it up with our receptionist upstairs on the 4th floor of the Board of Supervisors.
And carat diamond?
There doesn't seem to be a diamond, but I couldn't tell you. So if you are missing a ring, come to the 4th floor and get it. Thank you.